Steve. Thanks. Hi, everybody. It's us. It's Bill and Wendy. Welcome to the show. We're thrilled that you're here. Wendy, this is strange, and it's, I don't know, this is like a blast from the past. Somebody left their sunglasses here in the studio, and guess who makes these? Guess which company is responsible for the sunglasses I'm showing you?
I know.
Foster Grant?
It's not Foster Grant, Steve.
That was my guess, too, Foster Grant.
It is not Foster Grant.
Yves Saint Laurent?
Their ad campaign was, hey, isn't that you behind those Foster Grants?
Yeah.
It is the good people over at Blue Blocker. Remember those? Those were the sunglasses that were like...
No wonder no one's claiming them.
Those were, they've
been left here since the 70s.
Since 1975.
If those go unclaimed, I will take those.
Speaking of which, I was making fun of your sunglasses. Do you remember off the air I was making fun of Kevin's sunglasses?
I think I
whoa,
do, yeah.
Whoa.
They're too big.
What do you mean they're too big?
I thought they were a girl's. Like a girl movie star.
These are bigger, the Blue Blockers, but Kevin wants them.
I'll take those.
You'd wear these?
A good look.
Yeah. All right. You look like Gina Lola Bridget in them.
I don't know who that is, but I'm okay with that.
All right.
She was lovely.
we know her from the Flintstones.
Right. Gina Lola Jupiter from the Jetsons.
And Marg Rock.
Yeah. From the Flintstones.
Yes. Yeah. Kevin, I'm not really making fun of them. I'm just thinking they're a little big.
They're not a little big, Wendy. There's much bigger sunglasses out there in the world.
Yeah, Harry Carey's wearing them.
I'm not wearing like circus sunglasses here.
Kevin's head, though, I don't know if you've noticed this about Kevin. Very defensive. His head adapts to its surroundings. Like sometimes his head is bigger and sometimes it's smaller.
And speaking of big head, let's not talk about the Blackhawks hat you got.
Well, that was not personally purchased. It's just a ginormous one.
It's tomato.
Steve Cochran size. You figure if you make it big enough to fit Steve Cochran's head, it'll fit anybody.
That's how I go buying my sunglasses.
Give me the biggest sunglasses you got, Sunglass Hut.
Well, when did it come? Because you look back at all these, especially as I'm watching vinyl and stuff, this is in the 70s, they're ginormous glasses.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody had them.
Everybody
you look back
did.
At pictures. My husband had the giant glasses. That's just, they were in. That's how they made them. And then they went away, thank God. And now they're kind of coming back.
They're coming back because there's now a whole new tier of kids that didn't live through them the first time. Not just the sunglasses.
Be thankful.
But like pointy collars and stuff like that. Like stuff that was popular that we lived through.
All collars are pointed.
No, but some of them, like the 70s, they for some reason...
There was those tab collars.
Yeah. They were more angular, you know? Like all the stuff, like every once in a while I'll see somebody wear something from like the 70s era, and it's always somebody that didn't live through it the first time and doesn't know that we all woke up and went, what are we wearing? This is awful.
I love the bell bottoms, and
Do you? You wouldn't wear them now, though,
I'm
would you?
Them today.
Are you wearing them now? I mean, you should wear them. That's what I meant to say.
You look great in those.
You
bell
look fantastic
bottoms.
In them. You're bringing them back.
They're called boot cut now, aren't they? Or
well, these
like
are
that?
A little more. These are bigger
flares.
Yeah, they're flares.
Are
that's
they elephant
they're.
Bells?
No, but I wore palazzo pants, which was a long. It looked like you were wearing a long skirt because not just
those.
The bottom was flared out, the whole leg was flared out, so it looked like you had like a long dress on.
Right.
And I was a bit of a tomboy, and I had these red, white, and blue plaid palazzo pants that I loved. I was rocking them with my Converse high tops, and the hem was ripped on the bottom, and when I was running home for lunch, the tip of my Converse got stuck in the hem, and I fell, and I broke my collarbone.
Oh, no.
So those I've pants, never worn them again.
Those pants could have killed you.
I know.
I hope you enjoyed them. They could have been the
I didn't
death
really.
Of you.
Come on, I just said it out loud. Red, white, and blue plaid.
Well.
With Converse high tops.
That goes with everything. What couldn't you wear with that?
Maybe
that
your Converse were trying to save you.
Chuck Taylor, thank you. You saved my life.
And those have held up since the 70s.
Sure.
And those, I like stuff from the 70s. Trust me, I have a 16-year-old kid who thinks he's, you know, part of the 70s. Fringe jackets.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right, boot cut has like that little bit of flair at the bottom.
Yeah.
Very flattering on people.
And my tortoise Ray-Ban Wayfarers, they've held up. They're totally basic.
They're very big.
They're not that big.
You need a license to wear those, Kevin. That's too big. When the city insists you have a license for sunglasses, something's wrong.
Do they beep when you turn your head?
That doesn't even make sense.
I don't get. Yeah. Oh, back up the truck,
right?
Because okay, I get
he was
it.
Up there thinking about that one for a good couple minutes now.
Beep,
he's been
beep,
quiet.
Beep, beep, beep.
Do you
beep.
Remember? And Steve, I don't know if you had any of these, but when I was in college, I had not one, not two, but three different pairs of these, and that would be your Gerbeau pants that were like
Francois Gerbeau.
They were like genie pants. I could put a suitcase in those pants. I could walk around with a suitcase.
They didn't have them in Manteno.
No.
They never made them that far.
They didn't make them that far?
No, they had bib overhauls in Manteno.
There was a Gerbeau store that sold nothing but Gerbeau pants about a mile from here, and that's where I would usually go to get them, but Marshall Fields had them and Carson's had them, and I thought, because they were, I don't know what I was thinking. Like, I see pictures of it now, I just go, was I wearing a tent? Why would I have pants that big?
They were baggy.
Really baggy. Like, you could get, like, they had three different lines. They had kind of baggy, really baggy, and tarp. Like, if you went to a Cubs or White Sox game and it rained, they would just roll out a pants of, they would roll out the Gerbeau pants and cover the entire infield with them.
Well,
I had three pairs of those
think
at the same
about
time.
It. This is the time that you had your perm, probably.
Yeah, right around then, yeah.
And your turquoise gym shoes.
Yes.
Oh, that was
wear.
After.
I didn't wear them.
Will
I just
bring
would
them
tell.
In?
I'll bring them in. You know, I wore a pair of shoes the other day that when I brought home, one of my daughters just ripped me to shreds and said that those shoes are for people wear those shoes who have no idea what they're doing. That's what she said.
Are they the white ones?
They're the and Kevin has made fun of the same ones, the black and blue ones.
No, I think they're cool.
Black and blue.
But they're like very
cool.
90s.
How retro?
Kevin
retro
told me they were retro, and I didn't know they were retro. I thought I had no idea that they fit.
They almost
that.
Look like they should light up as you walk.
I'm trying to wire it so that happens.
Remember, Bobby Slayton had to get those shoes that light up when he walks.
Yeah.
How old is he? But he had to. Those were great fun shoes when you were little. Although
right.
They didn't have them when we were little.
No, they did not.
When our kids were little, they did.
They also didn't have, I've seen kids with this, I'm sure you've seen this too, and I think that's dangerous, and I wish I had these. These are tennis shoes that have wheels on them for when you need them.
The wheelies.
I was just
they're
thinking
wheelies.
Of those. Those were banned in some schools.
Yeah.
They didn't have those, right, when we were kids?
No.
Because I would have bought those.
Me
but
too.
Every time I see a kid with those, I say, that's just dangerous. I wish I had those. I would love to have a pair of those.
I got to see your black and blue shoes. I don't know what you're
I'll
not wearing
those
them today.
In. No,
I can't believe you don't remember them.
I really don't. I remember the white ones, and I don't know. There's no offense. Those are fine gym shoes. They're Nikes.
Thanks.
But white gym shoes to me are just dorky.
No offense, though.
I wear those like, I would say, 80% of the time.
I know.
I'm wearing them now.
I just, white shoes. No one wears white shoes anymore.
Just hate on our look,
that's not true.
And kudos to you, because when you go look at Nikes, there are so many colors.
So
that
Bill
you can't...
gets kudos on his what you said dorky shoes, and then my, right. You know, my sunglasses are just.
I didn't say they were dorky. I just
you
said they were too
dorky.
Big. I did not.
Oh, my sunglasses?
Yeah.
Well, I'm not. Yeah.
They are pretty big, Kev.
Bill, it was an issue in my marriage. The white sneakers.
Why? That's your standard. That's your standard
it's
color,
isn't it?
They go with everything.
They
what?
Do.
What did Sharon say?
Anything but white.
See.
No.
I'm just trying to help you. Terry doesn't say anything.
So if I wear white, it's bad, and if I wear black, it's bad. Those are your basic. Those are your. They go with everything. Colors, blue and I mean white and black.
They have really great Nikes now that are black or gray
oh,
with the white bottom.
There's every color in the universe. There's
except
every
white.
Color.
Do you have to
no,
special
sell...
order those from Geriatrics Plus?
No, if you go to any tennis shoe store, I would say easily a third of the shoes are just white. Right? You've seen that, haven't you?
I don't see white gym shoes ever anymore.
Where I get mine at Johnny's Youth Bootery in Ford City, that's where they're all white.
Isn't it the nurse's uniform store?
Yes.
Yeah, I go there too.
Get yourself right some much. Scrubs while you're there with little Mickey Mouse on it.
All right. I
can you believe all the scrubs they have now if you see them?
That's a big thing,
it
right?
It used to just be, you know, the
aquamarine.
Right.
Yeah.
And now you can get Mickey Mouse, Minnie Mouse.
Mm-hmm.
You can get Moose if you want.
I know.
All right, there's one thing that's acceptable, and George has it. Hi, George.
Hey, I just wanted to say I agree with the dorky white shoes. I just feel like I'm watching my dad at my high school white shoes, you know, clapping in the background. But
yeah.
Don't you guys remember, this is the biggest video this year, Damn Daniel, back at it again with the white Vans. He's bringing them back.
Vans can go any color.
Yeah, I know.
Get some Vans.
I know
you can't
play
tennis.
But I can't play tennis in those.
Well, have a wardrobe change before your games.
I keep these on because in case I get challenged to a match at any point during the day, I'm ready to play.
He's not kidding, people.
I always have a racket in the car on these shoes. I'm always ready. We appreciate it, George. Thank you so much.
Have a great day, you guys.
All right, you too.
All right, Dad, what's coming up next?
I'm going to yell at some kids to get off the lawn. That's coming up next. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
All right, we were talking gym shoes and sunglasses. We're going to take a picture of Kevin wearing his sunglasses. Can I clarify? They're too big, like when I looked at them.
Yeah.
And then I tried them on, and I felt like they were those fake Harry Carey glasses.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Sure. They look okay on Kevin.
Yeah, he pulls it off, I guess. Sure.
He should pull them off.
Yes.
He walked out, so it's easy to say.
He quit. That. He just quit.
No, but we're going to take a picture of him in his sunglasses. They look good on him. He can get away with a lot of stuff.
Right.
And we have a live blog going right now. So if you go to WGNradio.com/Bill and Wendy, mm-hmm. just whatever we talk about, there'll be a link to it or pictures.
Right.
It's much fun.
I think it is. You know, I'm mad. There's something I wanted to bring in to show you and read to you.
Show and tell?
It would have been show and tell, except that somehow I forgot to do it. But I'll kind of tell you what it is. There was one of the two. Every year, there's two really big comic book show that are held here in town. There's one at McCormick Place that was this weekend. It's called C2E2. And then there's one in Rosemont that's Comic-Con that's coming up in toward the end of the summer, I think, August. All right. So I went to the one at McCormick Place this weekend. And I know you were scheduled to go, but you didn't get to go, right?
No,
you were
I didn't. I was unable to go. The kids, well, Michael and Dylan went every day. No, Jim and Dylan.
Jim and
I don't even
Michael's
know who's at
Ireland.
My house. Yeah, thank
right.
you.
That's all right.
I would have forgotten.
That's all right. All right, so they have a thing, and they had it last year too, but this year it's even more pronounced. You get this, when you pay admission, you get this badge and like a necklace, and then you wear the badge so that you can walk in and out, and they know
a
that.
A lanyard?
So you could say lanyard. It's a
or
lanyard.
Or necklace.
It's a necklace. It's a lanyard. All right, so on it, it says, and there's also signs that say this. They say that cosplay... You know what that is, right?
When people dress up as their favorite figures.
People
action,
dress up yeah, like characters from either Batman or Star Trek or Harry Potter.
I think
Potter.
It's sexual, but that's just me.
What's it called, Bill?
It's called cosplay.
Like costume
play. And it wasn't a thing until a couple of years ago, and then all of a sudden it just erupted where when you walk around a convention like this, like I'm dressed like me. Most of the time, all the time,
that's
I come dressed
cosplay.
Like me, and then other people are dressed like me, and some of them look more like me than I do, so that's weird.
And there's also something, are those furries or something, where they dress as animals?
Some people do that, yep. But a lot of times you'll turn the corner and there'll be a woman who's dressed like Catwoman and she's hanging out with a guy who's dressed like Hagrid from Harry Potter, and that goes on a lot. And it says on the back of the ticket, of the badge that you wear to get in, and it says it on signs, cosplay is not an invitation to grope people.
It says grope.
Well, I can't remember the exact wording, but it's touch or grope or fondle or something. But it's their,
either way,
it's their
man.
Polite way of saying to you, just because somebody is dressed like Hermione, it doesn't mean you can touch them. And in my head, I can't figure out why anyone would think that was an invitation. But they take it seriously enough to where they put it on every ticket, and there's signs all over the place that say that. But I would never, like, if I saw somebody dressed like somebody, I wouldn't go, well, they obviously want me to grab them.
Well, there are a lot of fetishists that get involved in that, but
guess.
They're not going to C2E2 for it.
Right.
Which,
there's
by the
other
way,
conventions for that.
The Chicago Comic and Entertainment Expo, hence CCEE C2E2.
Right.
I was just curious.
Right. Right.
You remember the fire a couple of years ago? I think it was at a Rosemont hotel.
Yeah. I know where you're going.
And it came during a convention of these yes. people who dressed up in cotton.
The furries. What are they called? That's not the term.
Well,
bronies.
They dress like mascots or something. Is that what? Is
no,
that it? No.
Well, they do, but it's not mascots. It's a big costumes like that. But it was the middle of the night, and you've got all these, like, you know, Winnie the Pooh standing
outside
the
player. Well, I went. My cousin and I went on Friday, and I'm looking around, and for some reason, like, if you're a girl and you decide you're going to dress like Sailor Moon, do you know who that is?
No.
It's the Asian character. It's like I don't know much about it other than I know it's extremely popular in Asia and now it's popular here. And it's women dressed like, I don't even know how to describe it. They look like Asian schoolgirls for the most part. So everybody who is dressed like that, and I probably came across maybe 10 or 12 of them throughout the day I was there on Friday, guys just follow them around and take pictures of them.
Well, everybody takes pictures of everybody.
But I don't know what you...
Because
like,
they're dressed up. You didn't see a bunch of Rick Grimes from Walking Dead?
Yes.
Because people think that's
and
cool.
Indiana Jones.
Yeah, and they take pictures with them. My son Dylan was up on an upper level, and he saw these like furry people that I didn't even know what they were supposed to be. It's like no character that I recognized. One of them had a guitar and was jamming, and they're dancing around in this little courtyard, and then there's this sweet little girl who's dressed up, and Dylan took a video of it, and I'm like, this is disturbing to me. There's right. one little girl, and then there are these grown people in furry. It was.
Can
like,
I tell you where he gets that? I have been to the one in Rosemont with your husband Jim, and he gets so excited when he sees somebody. Like I've had to explain to him. I'll go, Jim. That's not really Marty McFly from Back to the Future. That's a guy. That's a guy from Itasca dressed like Marty McFly. He gets so excited when he sees those guys. It's amazing.
Well, Jim does, but Dylan's making fun of him. Because Dylan is like, look at this video I shot.
Right.
And there's just some guy dressed up as something like jamming with a guitar. And Dylan hit, I can't even remember what he said, but I was watching the video that he took. It's just, it's amazing. It's fun to go to.
There was a guy, now you tell me who this is because I don't know. There was a guy walking around just wearing his underpants.
And oh, that was Jim. That was my husband.
Baby Huey?
Steve, I swear to you, my cousin and I are looking at this guy, and he's about 30, and he's tall and wiry, and he's got like grease on his back and shoulders and neck and his legs.
Carl from Aqua Teen Hunger Force, maybe?
I don't know who that is. Is that who it was?
Was it Kramer from...
I thought it was, for a while, I'm like, that guy thinks he's Mowgli from Jungle Book? I go,
not
is he supposed to be
underpants.
Mowgli? No, what they weren't white. They were I
come on, you look.
No, the whole thing was so disturbing that I've spent the last 2 days trying to blank it out of my mind because I'm like, this guy doesn't even like comic books. He's just like walking around in his underwear. He was just walking around and like I said, he was all grimy on purpose with underwear on. The guy from Hunger Force is a possibility. I don't know,
and I am so unplugged. And Jim's into Star Wars. Dylan's into all the comic books. So yeah. He had a heyday and did a lot of shopping. It's great for shopping. And if you want to see panels and stuff.
Right.
Cliff Clavin was there.
He was there. Yeah. Yeah. Mary McDonald from Dances with Wolves was there.
Really?
Yeah. Because that's who the kids love is the lady from Dances with Wolves.
By the way, just getting a text from Jimmy Mack. They're called furries.
Furries. That's what it is.
Thanks, Jim.
That's what it is.
Very proud of you.
She won't be home for hours. You can put it back on.
We're laughing at you, not with you.
That's all right. He's taking some pictures of some hot girls wearing costumes.
Yeah, now this... All right, so Jim's
bleeding
sending
pool.
You... But now what is he going to do with those pictures? Doesn't that scare you a little bit?
I don't care what he does with them.
So
he needs a break from Star Wars anyway.
You're telling me so there's this convention where women dress up like little Japanese girls?
Yeah, like Sailor Moon characters, and then men... In their 60s, take pictures of them.
Well, sure they do.
It's the weirdest thing.
Clubs on Mannheim don't open until noon.
Stone Park. Stay out all night, discotheque.
A quick break. More show, Bill and Wendy WGN.
It's Bill Leff, Wendy Snyder, live from the Allstate Showcase Studio here on 720 WGN. I met Tim Ryan through a friend, and I can't tell you how happy I am that I met this guy. Knock on wood, no heroin problems in my family at this point. I hope they never come up, ever. But this is the man to help yourself, your son, your daughter, your partner, whomever. Tim Ryan, former heroin addict and now a man in recovery. Thank you for coming back.
Thanks for having us back.
Notice this article on the front page of Sunday Chicago Tribune, Hope Dealer, and I read it, and here's my take on this, and then you can go into detail. There are different people who think what you're doing is not the right way to quit heroin, and your mileage may vary in anything, whether it's losing weight, whether it's working out, becoming more healthful. Everyone has different ways of doing things, correct?
Absolutely.
And your way comes across sometimes as maybe brash, maybe honest, but you've been there. You witnessed it. And what better person to teach others?
Oh, I think that's a big difference. You know, there's a lot of people out there, You know, medical-assisted treatment, whether it's methadone, Suboxone, Vivitrol, out of those three, I'm for Vivitrol 1,000%. I'll back Vivitrol all day long. It's a shot you get once a month. It's non-addictive. It takes away the cravings and gives the individual time while in treatment to work with the clinicians and then get into recovery. But when you're using other things like Suboxone, I wish doctors would tell people, you know, Suboxone's 25 to 45 times more stronger than morphine. The half-life on how long it stays in the system, you know, I put 12 people in treatment in the past 6 months to get off of Suboxone.
Is addictive too?
Oh, it's highly, highly addictive. And when it first came out in 2002, the doctors were telling people this is not addictive. And the company that makes it, how do you pronounce that, Brad?
Rickard Benckenseier.
You know, they made $56 billion last year. Suboxone was 22% of their income.
This is a company that makes primarily household cleaning products.
Household cleaning products.
But they've branched off into pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, and then they had the pill form, and they went and patented a film strip so they could corner the market on it. And there was a big lawsuit to where they can't do it so people can get generic versions. One of my problems I see, now, can people on Suboxone and some on methadone turn their lives around? Absolutely. I just don't see it happening a lot. And a lot of the people that are on the state insurance, they'll go to a treatment center. The treatment centers will detox with Suboxone and then keep them on it for their 20 or 30-day stay. Give them their 30-day script. When they walk out of there 30 days later, they go to the local pharmacy to get their script filled, and they're not paying for it. The insurance will not pay for it. Now I've got a $300 to $500 bill to pay for this medicine I need, or I'm going to go into god awful withdrawal. That doesn't make sense.
So they're not going to get it, obviously, and then they start using again.
Absolutely,
probably.
Go right back to ripping and running. It should be used for short term detox only. But for some people, it works. You know, and I'm not knocking it. I wish more doctors that prescribed it really had a plan to get people off it and made sure that they were seeing a therapist, working with the clinician, getting into some type of recovery program. But you get a lot of people out there, you know, to be honest with you, talking out the side of their mouths that have never been on these and are trying to tell you what it's like.
For most people, when you have a heroin addiction and you go in and you're trying to get clean and you're trying to get sober, Is it possible to quit cold turkey, Tim, or is that just unheard of?
No, it's possible, but it doesn't happen too often. You know, heroin addiction or opiate addiction in general with the prescription pain pills, I mean, you're unleashing a dinosaur.
Yeah.
And when you're kicking the opiates, you're so profusely sick, all you're thinking about is getting more drugs, not to get high, to just get your sick off. You know, when I was in the peak of my addiction, I was just trying to feel normal. And there's so many addicts out there, whether they're on opiates, they're on methadone, Suboxone, they just want to feel normal again. And I've got a gentleman that we had sent down to Florida that was on 200 milligrams of methadone, 31-year-old man, had been on it for a number of years, and he's just celebrated 100 days clean. He said, Tim, I never thought I'd be clean. I thought I would be on methadone the rest of my life. And he spent 3 weeks in a medical detox, and it took him another 30 days just to start getting his bearings and his clarity, but he toughed it out.
When you have a family member or you yourself has a problem with heroin and you don't see light at the end of the tunnel, I know a lot of desperate parents call us when you're on the air, 312-981-7200, by the way, and they're looking for help, and you give it. And if you don't agree with one way, again, your mileage may vary. Different people respond to different things. But the thing is, you know, when I go to a doctor, if I'm trying to quit heroin, if they haven't quit it, I have a difficult time believing what they suggest. You've lived through it. To me, that matters more than anything.
Well, you know, even our clinical director, Suzette Papadakis with Banyan in Naperville, you know, she's got more degrees and knows this better than anyone. And she'll sit out honestly and say, look, Tim can get through to people I can't get through to. Why? Because he's lived it. My job is just to get someone convinced they need help. And I don't care where they go to treatment. But getting them in then and working with the clinicians to help with their their mindset, the cognitive behavior, whatever they want to work on. But then we work with them when they get out. We'll take them to 12-step meetings. We'll get them involved in Celebrate Recovery. If they want to do Smart Recovery, they want to go to church, see a therapist. We're just connecting people. For me, I live a 12-step program, but I don't care what people do. And if you try something and it doesn't work, we'll try something else. But the bottom line is people die.
Tim Ryan is here, A Man in Recovery. If you want more information, amirf.org. We'll talk to Tim and Brad, his youthful ward. That's coming up in just a little bit. If you have any questions or comments, 312-981-7200. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN. It's Bill Lapp and Wendy Snyder. Tim Ryan is here along with Brad. A Man in Recovery, amirf.org. Tim, if you're a parent and you suspect something is going on with one of your kids, give us a telltale sign or two. What are some of the key things to look for in a kid to know that they're having a heroin problem?
If they're in the opiate game, always look at their eyes. If their eyes are very pinned, they're on opiates.
What does that mean?
Their pupils are very small.
Okay, dilated pupils.
Very small. The color of their skin, they're losing weight, they're not taking care of their hygiene, they're not eating as much, things are starting to disappear, money missing, things are going to the pawn shop, they're not going to work, they're not going to school. And you need to do something. I tell parents to be aware is to be alive. We've got to drop the stigma. We've got to let people know that people like myself and Brad, we can turn our lives around here. But you better do something because, unfortunately, people die in the past 2 weeks. 14 deaths I've heard of in the Chicagoland area here. Not the heart of Chicago. That's in the suburbs.
From Dope to Hope really hits home right there. And whatever way you tell people things, it gets through to them. And Brad Gerke is with us. You work with Tim.
Yeah.
Man in Recovery Foundation, amirf.org. How long have you been heroin free?
Oh, just over 5.5 years now.
Congratulations.
That's great.
Thank you.
Good.
It's not been easy, has it?
You know, in the beginning, no, but as I got involved in a 12-step program, my life has turned around dramatically. I found this is the only disease that I come out of it better than I went into it. And it's truly a blessing. And then, you know, being with Tim and Man in Recovery Foundation and doing other 12-step work, turning around and giving back what was so freely given to me is truly the bright spot of my life today.
If you go to ChicagoTribune.com or you have Sunday's Chicago Tribune, read this article, Hope Dealer. It's about Tim Ryan. And it's really fascinating to me because a lot of loss in here. There are some kids, adults, people who die from heroin. And yet the parents of these people turn around and support your A Man in Recovery Foundation, and they want to keep and help other people because it's too late for their child.
Yeah, it is. And with, you know, our friend Mike Woods, unfortunately, that passed away, his father, Jim, I can remember Jim came to my support group a few weeks ago and said, Tim, thank you for the past 4 months with our son and the time over the holidays that he came there and spent. But this is such a progressive and chronic disease. That's why my recovery is first and foremost. I still go to 12-step meetings. I met with my sponsor yesterday. Without my recovery, I have nothing. And this is the only disease that'll tell you you're cured. And no pill is going to, you know, cure this. And Big Pharma's behind everything here. But, you know, due to, unfortunately, Michael's passing, we're able to put, I think, 13 people into treatment. Mm-hmm. We pay for them. I have an organization in out of state in South Carolina for $1,000. I can get someone in for 30 days. And then they work there and support their own program. We get their bus tickets. We ship them off. And we just try to give hope. But people need to understand wherever your kids go to treatment, they can walk out, check out against medical advice, and die. Most of the people that die from opiate overdoses are the first-time users, the people coming out of treatment, coming out of jail, or have been sober or abstinent for a little bit, and then go back and use. Just like my son, when Nick died, he was 50 days clean, and was first-time he used, and he died. And he never used a needle either. He snorted the heroin.
That's how naive I am. I thought that was the only way to do it. There are people saying that you only take people who have insurance, and that is totally not true because there have been numerous listeners who have called to this show, and we have forwarded their information to you, and they've called back to tell us, you know, can you get your bags packed and meet me at O'Hare tomorrow morning, and Insurance is a problem for people.
Insurance is a huge problem, and I'll set the record straight. My full-time job, I'm the Midwest Outreach Coordinator for Banyan Treatment Center out of Pompano Beach, Florida, and out of downtown Naperville. Naperville, we run a partial hospitalization outpatient program with no housing. I can take someone with a good insurance policy, a PPO, and put them down in our center for 90 days to 120 days. It's a step-down program. They're all over the country. Or they can go locally. I don't care. But that's my job. But I don't get paid whether I put 30 people in or two people. But I never wanted anyone calling and saying, oh, well, we don't have insurance. I had 100 phone calls yesterday. 32 of them were for people looking for help. Out of those 32, 8 had no insurance. We got 3 of them into detox. I'll help anyone. I don't care if they have state insurance, no insurance. I put people in everywhere. Someone else had quoted me in that article that, you only send to one center. No, I don't. They get on the phone, do the assessment. If they're not a fit, we're not taking them. But if someone's been to a treatment center 4 or 5 times, they should probably go somewhere else. Something is not working. Relapse is not part of the journey. That's the biggest fallacy. Well, how come you relapsed for so long, Tim? Because I was never in recovery. I was never into the solution of living recovery. It's not just going to meetings. It's everyday life.
We had Kyle the Kid up here a few times ago. He also works for you, mm-hmm. and he's young, right?
Yeah, Kyle's 19 years old.
And he was saying, Bill, do you remember this, how he had lost a girlfriend, he lost a friend, and he had to separate himself from his group of friends.
You have to change every aspect of your life.
So going to Florida may not be a bad idea.
Absolutely, but people can go to Florida and walk out and get high. What people don't understand is these are people over 18 years old. We can't keep them in treatment. They can walk out and do what they want. We can't force anyone to stay, but that's nationwide. And people die in every treatment center in the United States, every single one. This is a progressive and chronic disease. It's killing people. But what I'm trying to do is give them the opportunity. I won't just put you into treatment. I'll work with you when you get out.
You need more help.
Exactly.
The maintaining of
I'll flip it here. One of the big problems in Northern Illinois is sober homes. And the evidence base shows that if someone goes to treatment, going into a sober home and living there for 6 months to a year, learning the life skills, accountability is huge. But the problem is it's very difficult to open up sober homes in our communities. I don't want those people living next to me. I don't want those people living next to me. So we're trying to fix the problem. But in essence, the communities are making it a bigger problem when they're not letting these sober homes come in. The kid right next door to you is shooting heroin in that million-dollar home, but you don't want a house next to you with 10 people trying to turn their lives around? It's crazy.
That's a good question. AMIRF.org, that stands for A Man in Recovery Foundation. A lot of people have questions that we don't have time to get to, so go there for information. Is there a phone number people can reach you at?
Yeah, absolutely. They can reach us at 844-611-HOPE. That's 611-4673. And I do want to highlight real quick on the Connect for Life program that we're going to be kicking off in April in Naperville. Opiate addicts, heroin addicts can walk into the Naperville Police Department, ask for help, turn in their drugs. They will not be arrested, and we will guide and direct them into treatment. Danny Langlois with Dixon is spreading all over. I think he's put 48 people into treatment in 9 months.
And because of your foundation, A Man in Recovery Foundation, that's where you are able to help other people who can't afford treatment. So many desperate people have called and text, and unfortunately we're out of time here, but how can they get help?
Pick up the phone. Go to our website, www.amirf.org. Shoot us an email. Call the 800 number. We've got 6 people up here that are willing to help and give back.
All right. You are really on a mission and doing a great job. And again, you determine what's right for you as a parent or a friend or a person who has a heroin addiction. You decide which program is best for you,
exactly.
Which way to do it.
I don't care what they do. And if it doesn't work, try something else. But quit making excuses. Quit blaming. You know, you get all these advocacy groups. Let's get on the same page. You're good at this. I'm good at this. Let's work together. But people just want to shoot arrows. Whatever. I sleep good at night.
And you're helping a lot of people, and I like that you're so vocal about it, because people are ashamed of heroin addiction. People are ashamed that their kid is an addict or that they are. There's no shame. We need to get
They made a bad choice. They made a bad choice that unleashed a monster. It's as simple as that. And we need to throw a shout out to the mayor of Naperville, to his wonderful wife. She's your number one listener.
Thank you so much. And continued success. We'll be hearing more from Tim Ryan, Brad Gerke. Good luck to both of you.
Thank you.
AMIRF.org, A Man in Recovery Foundation. And that number again, Tim?
That Tim number Ryan. Again is 1-844-611-4673.
Thank you guys. So much.
Appreciate it. News is next, and then a lot more show. Bill and Wendy, WG. Steve, thanks. It's Bill Leff and it's Wendy Snyder. Hey, Steve, today is the 10-year anniversary of something big, something that revolutionized the world. Do you know what it is?
I do.
Go on. What is it?
Twitter?
It is Twitter.
Yeah.
Today is the 10-year anniversary.
I thought it was Twister.
No, not Twister.
I brought in Twister for us
no.
to play during our lunch break.
Twister's been around for almost 50 years.
Right hand red. Damn it.
I know more about Twister than I do about Twitter.
Milton Bradley's got a hot one.
It's the Twister.
It's the Twister.
Spin the spinner and call the shots. Twister's got you tied up in a knot.
In a knot.
It's Twister. Yeah, it's hard to believe, but Twitter, I never would have guessed it's been around for 10 years. I just heard about it Wednesday. It's very popular, apparently.
It's changed the way I do my job, I'll tell you.
Has it changed the way you do your job? Yeah,
that's absolutely.
You get your news there quicker than anything else.
That's so interesting, because I like to consider myself fairly up on the news, and I'm not hooked up to Twitter, and I can guarantee you I'll go my whole life without ever being hooked up to Twitter.
Bill, a lot of people, they sign onto it. They don't actually get hooked up to it.
I don't know.
He signed up for it, but he doesn't do anything with it.
I sent in an application. They never sent anything back.
I hopped on right away because, you know, your name goes away. There's more than one Wendy Snyder in this world, so I signed up for it right away. And so I could use the at Wendy Snyder.
But didn't they do a thing where they said, like, isn't there a branch of it that would say, like, the real Wendy Snyder? Am I imagining that? Isn't there some way that
you
to differentiate?
You can get verified. You can get a little check mark, but you have to tweet a lot in order to do that.
So then Twitter somehow screens you to know that you are who you say you are? Is that what that means?
No, you apply to be verified and then...
And how do they do it? What do they do to verify you?
They just, you know, determine whether you're widely enough known and
And we were able to all get verified here, but I never sent the information. And Julie DeCaro was handling that back when she was here.
When she used to work here, sure.
But Twitter is how I found out Michael Jackson died.
Because that stuff, you didn't.
I'm not kidding you. I was out.
That
I was.
Had to be the early days.
Well, it was less than 10 years ago, so.
Yeah.
Michael Jackson died less than 10 years ago.
I'm telling you, that's how I found out that he died. I was not at work, and, you know, I have my phone with me all the time.
How does it decide what stories to alert you to?
Well, you follow people. You are just, really, put your white gym shoes on and go have a egg salad sandwich for lunch.
I wait until the newspaper boy on the corner yells out a headline, and that's when I know it's important.
Timmy Long, where have you been?
That's how I know that the story is important.
I'm telling you, it is... Just you follow CNN, you follow Steve Bertrand,
so
you follow WGN.
When there's a big story, Bill, like, you know, let's say San Bernardino.
Right.
And then people will write information stories and they'll hashtag it San Bernardino. I can set up a column on my tweet deck to get every hashtag San Bernardino story. So I'm hearing from witnesses or relatives of people just as soon as anyone else.
Oh, okay. All right.
Or you could. I mean, there's nothing magical about.
But in the case of Michael Jackson, you had said that you knew because you followed him. If you didn't follow Michael Jackson, would you have gotten that alert?
I didn't follow Michael Jackson.
It just decided, AP said, this is a huge story. We need to let Wendy know.
No, they tweet something, and if you follow them, it goes on your news feed. Right now, here's the first one I have.
What?
JCPenney. 94% of Americans say they wouldn't pick up a penny. Here's the reason why 100% of you should. So maybe, plus we get show ideas on here.
And they alerted you to that story,
well,
though?
Well, no, they didn't alert me. They sent out they tweeted, Chicago Blackhawks, boys are ready for any meal on the go with tonight's lunchbox giveaway. So I follow the Chicago Blackhawks. So I tweet the games live some of the times. Rick Pearson, Richard Lewis, Sven Gulli.
Bill, I love how little you know about this.
I don't know anything about it.
The Who. I follow The Who. Whole Foods Market. Easter's just around the corner. And then you've got People Magazine, E! Online, Huffington Post Live, BuzzFeed, USA Today, AOL. So I get all the news that they're tweeting, which is very current stuff,
yeah.
I just look at and find news.
So,
oh my
for
God,
somebody
Grandpa,
who...
seriously.
Because I, you know, I get it on the television. I get it on the radio. I get it online.
What if you're right? at the beauty parlor, which you won't be?
You don't know that.
I don't even call it the beauty parlor. If I'm getting my
I may
hair
go in
done.
For a sprucing up. You don't know.
You'll just follow it and say, oh my, you know, sometimes you'll just sit on the couch and go, oh, let me see what's going on. And then you see all the breaking news.
Yeah.
Chicago White Sox, just 2 weeks from today, we'll be getting ready for Chicago White Sox opening day.
See, now I knew that and I'm not on the Twitter.
Better
I just
call
knew
Saul.
That imperatively and intuitively. I knew that. Well, here's what they've done over at Twitter. They have put together what they call their milestone moments. They've been in existence as of now for 10 solid years. So they've put together the highlights of those 10 years from a Twitter standpoint. Can I share them with you now?
Please.
All right. In March of 2006, exactly 10 years ago, a man created the first sketch of Twitter. This is he's considered to be the father of Twitter. Do you know what his name is?
John Twitter?
It's not John Twitter. It's Jack Dorsey. Now, you would think if a guy like Jack Dorsey was the one to come up with something as big, like we all know who invented radio and television and the automobile. Why isn't Jack Dorsey like a household name?
Marconi, Edison, Ford.
Yeah.
Okay, just trying to.
Why doesn't Jack Dorsey get the same respect that those guys get?
Because it's not in history books yet. It's only 10 years old. It's still a baby.
Yeah.
It's not even a tween.
It's 10 years old.
Yeah, but that's not that old.
Jack Dorsey created the first sketch of Twitter 10 years ago today. That same month, he sent out the first tweet, except nobody got it because nobody was hooked up to Twitter. So he wasted his tweet. Hope he gets money back. In August of the next year, the hashtag, that's the thing that looks like the number sign, was first proposed by a man named Chris Messina. Now, I know a guy named Chris Messina. It couldn't be the guy I know, could it be?
I don't know. Your connections everywhere.
I know a lot of people.
You know a lot of people.
I know the guy that ran Twitter for years and years.
That's
I told
what
you,
you
that.
Say.
Dick Costolo. He's a friend of mine from Second City.
And how come he won't be on the show?
It's the this is the weirdest thing in the world. When I was at
Your
Second City,
don't ever want to be on the show.
My friends refused to be on the show.
Shame on them.
When I was at Second City, there was a guy there, a really quiet, very funny guy, very good writer, Dick Costolo, and we all kind of knew this guy has got something going, but he's not going to be in comedy, but he's brilliant. And then years later, I read about him that he was the head of Twitter. That's not bad.
Well, he could have told us that had he been on the show.
I know.
And who's the other guy you know?
Who's the
other
guy
Twitter guy you know? Christmas time?
I know a guy named Chris Messina, but I don't know if it's the same Chris Messina. I don't know. is that a common name?
I would imagine.
I know a lot of guys named Chris Messina. Okay, there's more of these. As it turns out, Twitter is now 10 years old, and they have put together over at Twitter the milestones of Twitter. We'll tell you more of these next. Give us a call. Give us a text. Or Twitter us. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.
All right, quit picking on Bill. People get to choose how they get their news. I'm on Facebook, and I don't need something else to follow and waste my time on. And really,
exactly.
You can't wait till your hair is done to get news.
Right.
Unless it's the apocalypse, don't think it matters.
Nah, if there's the apocalypse, you'll hear screaming and yelling from every direction.
You could follow Loggins and Messina.
All right, now you made it tempting.
Wendy is mean. She thinks she knows it all. I don't know everything, but I do know that Bill doesn't know how to use Twitter. Would I be correct in that?
Don't you think, though, that the way society is structured now, everybody judges their value on how many followers they have on Twitter or friends, quote unquote, they have on Facebook or things like that, like things that really don't matter. Everybody now thinks it matters because I got a billion people following me on Twitter.
If you have a billion, then it matters. If you don't, I don't think anybody cares how many they have. They just want to post stuff like Instagram. You know, kids just post, not even kids. Everybody posts pictures. I haven't gotten into that. But Twitter, I have found to be very useful in getting breaking news.
All right.
If you follow the news companies.
But I don't feel like there's never been a story that has just eluded me because I'm not on Twitter. Like, if something big is happening, I find it out. It's not like there's a billion things going on that I'm like, oh, God, I didn't know that was happening.
Well, being on the radio.
Wait, Donald Trump is running for president? I didn't know that.
Not like that, but when the guy was caught in Paris, the mastermind behind the Paris attacks, he was caught in Brussels. That came over on Twitter and my AP alert. And
but couldn't that have waited 20 minutes? Like,
no,
did
I'm
you
on
need
the air.
To know?
I kind of want to know exactly what's
but
going
Kevin
on.
Would have told. I mean, Kevin would
know.
Have,
I have to say, it has changed the way we operate up here.
Yeah, but, big
but,
time.
But the news business, yes, I could see where the news business because they have to keep
we're
up.
We're in the news business.
To the second, no, but when I go home, like, let's say that happened. I went home, and the guy in Paris was caught. They wouldn't. They weren't going to call me in to help apprehend the guy. I didn't need to know that second. Well, it could have waited 10 or 15 minutes, right?
I just like to think you could tell your friends.
Yeah, I like I to guess. Be on top of things.
I guess.
When, who died? When George Martin died. That came across on Ringo Starr's Twitter feed at like 10 at night. I follow Ringo Starr, and I'm like, wow, George Martin died. And then nobody knew if it was real because somebody hacked his account 2 weeks ago.
Right.
But I just like, yeah. you know...
It's also really great for like sporting news,
yeah.
like breaking trades and things like that. Always hit Twitter first.
You don't have to be plugged in. I'm not saying you have to be, but on the air, I like to find out exactly what's going on because I feel like we should know.
Right.
I know we have a
but
news department.
I trust Kim. Kim, I trust you. So I know if
Thanks,
something
though.
Big happens during the show.
I trust you too.
Kim would certainly jump in and say,
what if Kim's not
Martians
here?
Martians have landed. Then I don't trust you, Bertrand.
See what
if,
I mean?
If Kim is here, I would certainly believe it. Here's some other highlights from the world of Twitter. It's 10 years old, by the way. It's not accepting.
Birthday.
It's not accepting gifts. In January of 2009, when a U.S. Airways flight made an emergency landing in the Hudson River, the photo was posted.
Sully?
Sully Sullenberger. So that was one of the biggest moments in Twitter. Ashton Kutcher, in April of 2009, became the first person on Twitter to reach 1 million followers.
He deserves it. He's handsome as hell.
All right, so this is a good example. Back in the days when Ashton Kutcher was on That 70s Show, would you or anybody you know have said, someday I want to know all of Kelso's private thoughts. I want to know everything that that guy's thinking.
The minute
it happens, I want to be aware. If that guy's talking about something, I want in on it instantaneously. Would that have made sense to you?
It's not like it interrupts what I'm doing. It's when I look at my Twitter account. If you don't look at it, you don't see it. Who cares?
All right.
I've always wondered what kind of food he would make himself.
It's just kind of like scrolling through your Facebook newsfeed. I mean, you know, there's some things you are interested in, the other things you just ignore.
And Twitter's more immediate, wouldn't you say?
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
In January of 2010, astronaut TJ Creamer, which, by the way, I put in coffee. I don't even drink coffee. I'll just put a little TJ Creamer in my coffee, sent the first tweet from space, the first space tweet.
That's not exciting to you?
It depends on what it is.
That it's coming from space.
Well, the fact that they're in space is impressive enough. I don't need anything beyond that.
All right, 773 sums it up best. Bill, texting from a flip phone here. You don't need to justify a thing. Luddites unite.
Thank you. Thank you. Now, I could retweet that if I wanted to, couldn't I?
You're being condescending. I don't care if you're on Twitter or not.
So that the guys from That 70s Show know what I'm thinking?
I love it.
You know, Bill, for those of us who are addicted to it, I do respect you because you're probably a lot more relaxed
and laid
back
than a lot of us.
But that's
the problem, is I know so many people who get, like, constantly, and you're one of them, like everything that happens is like, wow. I like life to just happen at a better pace.
You don't care about anything that doesn't interest you, really.
No, that's not true.
Well, you don't care as much about anything that doesn't interest you.
I don't want to be bothered by stuff that doesn't interest me. Why would anybody want to be bothered? Like you just told me you're following how many different sources?
I'm just trying to explain to you, I'm only following 800 people or organizations because I haven't had time to sit down and go through who I want to follow. But it's just... I enjoy it, so
no.
Leave
then
me
you
be.
Should go for you. Then you should. In January of 2011, the pro-democracy protests in Cairo unfolded on Twitter as an expression of Arab Spring. Now, I'm surprised that would make their top 10 moments, but
yeah.
That doesn't seem as big of a deal to me.
See, I wouldn't have been excited if that came over as a tweet. I would have said, "So what?
What's this? The pro-democracy protests in Cairo are going on?" In November of 2012, President Barack Obama marked his presidential win with a tweet, which at the time became the most retweeted tweet. Do you know what it was? I don't know. It's just probably thank you for voting for me, something like that.
Yeah, and just that he had an account.
Yeah. In December of that same year, just a month later, Pope Benedict became the first pope to join Twitter.
Even before you.
Creating 9 accounts.
Nine.
To tweet in different languages.
God love him.
Good
and he
for
does.
Him. Yep. Yes, he has to. That's part of the job description. In April 2013, more than 27 million tweets were sent about the Boston Marathon as the world discussed the bombings, the manhunt, and then the spirit of Boston. July of 2013, anticipation of Prince George's birth, saw 2 million tweets.
Who cares?
That one, that's my it? Point. 2 million people went, there's a royal baby coming.
Oh, but I love that stuff.
And a lot of people are into it. And quite honestly, I have a lot of interest. So I like to see what's out there and what's happening in the world.
Right.
I don't like to have blinders on.
Right. And then there's one more. December of 2013, the passion of the revered South African statesman Nelson Mandela, age 95, tweets about his death spiked at 95,000 tweets per minute.
He tweeted about his own
no,
death?
No, he did not. No.
Wow, that
he
is
did,
good.
They have not. They don't have that technology yet.
Oh, who's going to be the first person to tweet from beyond? That's what I want to know. You wouldn't be impressed by that?
In March 2016, Twitter shuts down after Bill Leff admits on air that he thinks the whole thing is a waste of time.
Like CNN right now, Apple and the U.S. Department of Justice will finally battle before a judge this week. It's not like I need to know that to continue my life. But
isn't but most of those messages they send out would fit that category, wouldn't you say? Most of them are like, oh, okay, good to know. But
yeah,
life goes on.
Yeah, don't you scroll through your Facebook feed?
Yeah, from time to time. But it's not on me 24 hours a day, like constantly going, hey, this happened, hey, this happened, hey, this happened. Like, you know how we have said, we talked about this last week. When I go home, I put my phone down and that's it. I don't deal with it anymore. Like, you could never do that, could you?
I usually have, when I'm home, it's, I guess I still have it around me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm the conduit for a lot of things. If the kids are out, I have to see when they need to be picked up.
But I think more people are fitting that category now. Just observing people in life, people are driving and texting. People are in restaurants, not talking to the person sitting across from them.
Yeah, I see
them.
That all the time.
They're texting instead of talking to whoever they're there with. So I just, like, that scares me. I know it's technology, but I like living life, not tweeting about life or getting texts about life. I like living it instead of having somebody show me a picture of it.
I like to see what's going on. Although, when you think about it, a lot of stuff is extraneous because, as I mentioned to you, the one thing I remember is the day Michael Jackson died, I found that news via Twitter.
Yeah.
That was probably one of the biggest things that I remember.
Right.
So, I mean, you just look at it and go, oh, that's nice. Oh, wow, really? Oh, who cares?
Sure. Sure.
You know?
Sure.
To each his own.
All right. A break. Some
happy
news.
Birthday, Twitter.
Happy birthday, Twitter. You look fantastic. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.
1, 2, 3, 4. Tell me that you love me more. Sleepless, long nights.
It's Bill Leff and it's Wendy Snyder. Wendy, here's something interesting. Almost a year ago, Eric Zorn wanted us to throw an adjective at the front of his name.
That's how long this has been going on?
It's been almost a year now. This because Steve Dale has the adjective noted pet expert. And
which
Eric
you gave
was,
him.
Thank you. Eric was a little jealous.
He was.
He was. So he said, I'm going to come up with an adjective every week. Well, now an adjective seems to have stuck. The word feisty, Eric, is the word that seems to be the one that describes you best. Is that
Steve
right?
Steve Dale can be noted, and I can be feisty.
Nothing wrong
and,
with that.
And I'm feeling feisty, and I think I will continue to be feisty all the way through the November elections.
What's creating all this feist? Is it politics?
Oh, my goodness. What isn't happening these days? It's just such an amazing story and such a confounding story is what's going on. Right now, the Republicans are trying again to mount some sort of a stop Trump effort.
Mm-hmm.
They're imploding. Mm-hmm.
Mitt Romney goes campaigning with Kasich in Ohio, and then he comes back to Utah, and he says he's going to vote for Ted Cruz. They're flailing right now. We've got a couple of interesting events this week. We have the Utah caucuses, which Trump is leading in. I mean, the polling in these caucuses is not all that exciting.
It's over. Trump's the guy.
But it looks as though Cruz is going to win. The question is, if he gets more than 50% of the vote in the Utah caucuses, then he gets all the delegates, which is important. Right now, it's a delegate contest. It always has been, but it really has come down to, can they keep Trump under, you know, what is it, 1,232?
The magic number.
The magic number that he's got to get to. Arizona right now, Trump's leading in all the polls, but everyone tells me that Cruz is better organized in Arizona. He's got a better get out the vote effort. So Arizona may be closer than we think, but Trump is supposed to win that. And then in a week and a half, we move on to Wisconsin.
I think that's the date. I didn't bring my little GOP primary calendar with me, but in any case, Wisconsin's going to be a huge test because Governor Walker, if you remember, who years ago was running for president and dropped out, he's going to be behind the Stop Trump effort. Probably will put his lot in with Cruz.
Yeah,
and you know, Wisconsin's going to be an interesting state because it's not, you know, one of these states with a whole ton of evangelicals in it. So
I have a stupid question.
Yes,
that's really stupid.
That's fine.
Why did they let him go through the motions in the first place if there were doubts?
Well, they couldn't stop him, right? How could they have stopped him?
Wouldn't it have been easier to stop him then than now? Now it just looks terrible for
that party. Yeah, well, Wendy's right. I mean, you're right, Bill. They couldn't have legally stopped him.
Right.
Anyone can run, but the question is, why didn't they organize? Why didn't they see this coming? And I guess...
Why didn't they pick a candidate who was better than any of them?
Well, how many were there? There were 17, I think, 17
originally.
Republicans who were running.
Yeah.
And, of course, the question is, you know, why didn't they get out in front of this and try to discredit him earlier?
Yep.
And I think the answer is the same reason that most of us in the media didn't take Trump all that seriously. We're like, oh, this is amusing.
It'll come and go.
This TV star with his funny hair is going to come and run for... He visited our boardroom in June. And he had just announced, and there was that really ridiculous announcement where he comes down the escalator. Do you remember the video of this? And then there were also reports that he had to hire actors to come and cheer him on at his announcement because he couldn't get enough actual supporters into this lobby where he gave his announcement. And he had said this horrible thing about all the Mexican immigrants are rapists, or many of them are rapists, and NBC had disassociated themselves from him, and Telemundo, whoever it was parting company with him on the Miss Universe pageant. There's all kinds of stuff. So it was like, it looked like just a train wreck right from the start, and nobody really thought that they needed to organize behind him. And then, you know, the snowball started rolling down the hill and just started crushing people who decided they were going to try to stop him.
He wouldn't have had to ask Scott Baio more than once, because you saw that he's come out and support.
He wants
he talks
Trump.
Like I do.
The important Chachi.
Where Scott, have you been lately?
Scott Baio's plan is he hopes that Trump will be a little more pointed in his discussion of Hillary Clinton, that he'll be meaner to Hillary Clinton. That's what Chachi is saying.
Chachi,
yeah, that's what he wants. Let's say Trump doesn't reach that magic number of delegates and they have what they call a brokered convention,
right,
which is a flowery way of saying, uh-oh, we're in some serious trouble now.
It's basically an open convention.
Right.
There aren't brokers anymore. There's no one who can really sit down and say, okay, here's what we're going to do.
Right.
It's going to be a free-for-all.
But the scenario is, and several people have hinted at this, is that the bigwigs of the Republican Party could say he doesn't have the magic number and he's not the guy we want anyway. And then Trump has said if that happens, you could expect some rioting, you could expect some problems, which is the Trump way of saying, I want you guys to do some horrible things. He just says, expect it. I'm
Isn't
not telling
that irresponsible?
It's extremely irresponsible.
I don't know if his delegates themselves are going to cause trouble in the convention hall in Cleveland, but certainly outside on the streets they might. But even bigger than that is, are they going to vote? Are they going to rebel at the ballot box?
Mm-hmm.
Are they going to show up for the Republican candidate who gets picked? You know, in Kasich, John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, is staying in the race. He could mathematically win all the votes in all the rest of the primaries and caucuses. He would not have enough delegates to be nominated in the first ballot in the convention. He's staying in the race because what he's hoping, he'll be in third place almost for sure. Well, there's only three candidates left, and he's way behind Ted Cruz even. He's hoping to get to this convention and have it just turn into this free-for-all, and all the delegates are loosed from their obligations after the first ballot or second ballot, depending on the rules of the state. And then everyone's going to say, well, who are we going to nominate? My prediction is that if this happens, they'll go for Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, Republican Wisconsin congressman, who ran for – who was, if you remember, he was Mitt Romney's vice presidential candidate.
Does he look better now given the choices?
Way better, doesn't he?
He's very buff. Is that what you're talking about?
No, but I mean, you know, had he been...
Like a more viable option?
Had he been in the mix to begin with, I don't know how well he would have done, but now it's like he's the savior.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, he's got conservative bona fides. He's
Speaker of the House looks good on a resume.
And it looks pretty good, yeah. And he's brainy. He's very nerdy. He's been up to see us at the Tribune, too. And he's a geek, almost. He's a policy wonk. And you kind of need that. I think if you're going to be running the government, you need to have a really good grasp of details, and he does have that. But I think he has been through a national campaign. He didn't win, but he's been, you know, vetted and examined by the media, so there's going to be no surprises. If you pull somebody, you know, off the floor who you don't know, who hasn't been through this, suddenly you're going to run a risk of having someone like a Sarah Palin. You just don't know what's going to come out.
Yeah.
So that could happen. But what we're seeing here is that this whole process is being exposed for the kind of strange contraption, sure. this Rube Goldberg device that it is, that you know, we play it as journalists as though, oh, it's a state by state, and they vote, and they roll up delegates, and they win. But you know, even how the states ultimately pick the delegates who go and where their loyalties are, all of that, it may come into play. It never has before. But if you remember, 4 years ago, Ron Paul, the dad, he would like get wiped out in these primaries and caucuses, and then his supporters would go to state conventions that followed up on these primaries, and they would engineer their way into getting, you know, sometimes 10, 15, 20 delegates out of these places where they won almost nothing because the rules are so strange. So all of a sudden we're going to realize that it's not quite this exercise in democracy that we think it is, that there's a sort of facade.
But that's the problem, is to the average American, to the average voter, who they go, wow, we've been following this thing for a year now, and we went state by state, and you guys made such a big deal.
Yeah.
And then out of nowhere, some guys in a smoky room somewhere decided it's going to be Paul Ryan.
Yeah, rule,
what's the point?
Yeah, Rule 16 says that we can ignore these votes, and we can take these delegates, and they can say they're for Trump, but they can actually be for Cruz.
Yeah.
So that's going to really upset people.
Oh, yeah.
So
Eric Zorn is here. Is he feisty? Absolutely, he's feisty. You hear him. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN. That's going to happen. Eric Zorn is here, Chicago Tribune columnist, talking about the events of the day. Let's talk a little bit about the Supreme Court justice pick, if you wouldn't mind, Eric. I know you got into some hot water over the weekend, didn't you?
You forgot my adjective. You just
the feisty Eric Zorn. The feisty Eric Zorn.
I was feeling pretty feisty about this pick. Last Wednesday, President Obama nominated Merrick Garland from Lincolnwood to be the next Supreme Court justice, and I thought it was a very cautious pick on his part, and it was deferring to this Republican obstructionism. And you know, as you know, the Republicans have said, we're not going to even give this guy a hearing, no matter who you nominate. We're not going to give you a hearing,
which is so rude. Just at least go through the motions and then say no.
Well, I think the idea that Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, had was that he would get out in front of this so that it didn't look personal. That he said it. I mean, Scalia was still, you know, being trans. His body was still on the way to the morgue when McConnell came out and said, you know, there's no way that we're going to even give a hearing or a vote to anybody who Obama nominates because it's too close to the election. We want the next president to nominate this. So he insulated himself from the charge that it wasn't personal. So Obama's play in this was to nominate this guy Merrick Garland, who's a veteran D.C. Circuit judge with a moderate record. He's someone who seems to be, you know, sort of straight down the middle, calling the balls and strikes. He is, I think, on the left, maybe, but he could end up being like a David Souter, who was appointed by Republican president and then turned out to be kind of liberal. So you just don't know sometimes. And he's also 63, which the tradition has been that you nominate a younger justice, someone maybe in his late 40s or his or her late 40s or early 50s, so that your stamp on the court is longer. Mm-hmm. He is the oldest Supreme Court nominee since the early 70s. He's older now than John Roberts, Chief Justice John Roberts, is right now.
Yeah.
So it looked like this was Obama was saying, well, okay, I'm going to
compromise a little.
Well, I'm going to compromise. I'm going to give you this guy who is really kind of in the middle, kind of daring you to do this, to say no, to stop, block this nomination. And you know, what I think that he probably should have thrown a longer pass on this, that he should have gone with like Sri Srinivasan, the Indian born judge on the D.C. court, who is, I think, 13 years young. I think he's like 50. Paul Watford, I think his name is, Watford, who's an African American man out in the Ninth Circuit out in California, or this Ketanji Brown Jackson, African American woman. I think that the kind of a pick reflects the diversity of the country, and it also is a kind of pick that would excite the Democratic base. By giving the Republicans this really moderate, mushy pick, and letting them turn that pick away, he's giving the Republicans the deference of saying, like, okay, I take your point. You have the right to do this. I think he needed to fight them a lot harder on this. And it's something that I've had this feeling about Obama for a long time, which is when he gets right down to this hardcore negotiation with the Republicans, he tends to back off. He seems to think he can compromise with them, but they want to compromise. They're interested in compromise. And the example that always has stuck in my craw for years now was when he extended, there's Bush-era tax cuts, right? Remember that? They had the tax cuts. And there's the Democrat proposal was, okay, we will keep those tax cuts for everybody but the highest earners. The highest earners are going to lose their tax break. And the Republicans said, no, we want the highest earners to get a tax break too.
Mm-hmm.
And this polled so well for Democrats. I mean, this is a really popular thing, like make the rich pay a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And the Republicans just said, no, we're not going to do it. And Obama blinked, basically said, okay, well, they can have their tax cut too, thinking that he could negotiate with them. And they just rolled him on it. And I was so mad about that. And I feel like in this case that they've kind of rolled him again. They've let him nominate this guy, Merrick Garland. And my guess is that when we get close to the November election, if it looks like the Democrat is going to crush Donald Trump or Ted Cruz, that they'll go, okay, well, we'll take Merrick Garland, rather than saying, because they don't want President Hillary Clinton or President Bernie Sanders, because they're going to nominate somebody who's more liberal and younger, have a bigger stamp on the court. And so I think that he needed to make an opening gambit at least here that was stronger than that to try to lay down his marker. This is who I would nominate if I had the same prerogative that so many presidents have had before me.
What about the train of thought of he is a lame duck president, even though he still has 8 months in office? Many people have said he's a lame duck president. We have no business listening to anybody under his consideration. Wait till the next president is in. That's ridiculous.
Well, the obvious argument is that he was elected for 4 years.
Yeah.
And that, he wasn't elected for 3 years.
Yeah.
So, but the counterpoint to that is I have to ask myself, and I think all of us who consider ourselves on the left on this have to ask themselves, would we be saying the same kind of thing if this were President Mitt Romney right now, and President Mitt Romney was trying to nominate an arch conservative judge? Would we be saying, hey, wait a minute, we're having an election here, it's coming up, it's too soon? Certainly there are quotes. Wendy alludes to Joe Biden saying something very similar to this. It was a hypothetical back then in the early 90s, but he did say
the Biden rule.
He said, well, we shouldn't consider, now that the campaign season has started, we shouldn't do this. So that, I think there's a lot of hypocrisy on both sides. And if I thought that the Republicans were saying, okay, we'll meet in the middle, we'll take this guy who's kind of a moderate, we don't know where he's going to go, but that is what the electorate said. So I wish that Obama had played a stronger hand and tried to force the issue a little bit more. I think that would really excite the voters, and I think Democratic voters are going to need to be excited this fall. So
Dazzle us,
please. Dazzle us. Really quickly, since you brought up Mitch McConnell's name, because he doesn't get that many mentions on the show. I know he and Harry Reid are polar opposites on pretty much everything in the world, but they look exactly the same to me. I can't tell the difference between those two guys.
Well, Mitch McConnell's one who looks more like a turtle, and Harry Reid's the guy who now wears sunglasses all the time because he had that exercise equipment accident. So that's how you know.
Every time I see one of them on the news, I guess wrong every single time. I never know who's who.
Just remember the turtle and the sunglasses.
And
Thanks, Mr.
guy.
Feisty.
That's Feisty Eric Zorn. Read him in the Chicago Tribune.
And listen to me on the Mincing Rascals podcast with me, Kristen McQuarrie, John Williams, and
Steve Bertrand.
Oh, boy, that's
you say
a great
your
impression.
Name so well.
That's a great impression of Steve, Eric. All right, we'll talk to that same Steve Bertrand next. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.
Oi.
I'm sorry, what?
Oi.
What makes
TNT
you,
or Dynamite? Because that's
what
they sing in this.
Oh, they do.
Is this Brian somebody? I can never remember who's singing AC/DC. I know that the one guy can't sing anymore.
Scott.
I don't think this is Bon. Brian Johnson?
I don't know if this is Brian Johnson or not.
I'm not sure.
Maybe it is.
Not as cultured on AC/DC as I should be.
I'm not either.
That's going to be our downfall. We should take a class.
I was just going to say that.
I know they must teach a class on AC/DC lore.
It is Bon Scott. All right. Good to know. There's some guy who was on. Did you ever watch Talking Dead after Walking Dead?
No, because I'm always afraid they're going to give out some secrets to the future of
the
episodes.
Never,
they don't?
Never, ever.
No,
do.
I don't watch it.
They recap what has happened. And last night after The Walking Dead, Chris Hardwick, who hosts Talking Dead, had a teacher who teaches a class, a literature class, on The Walking Dead.
Really? And this, college class?
I think it was a high school.
Oh, wow. That's impressive.
Somewhere in California. And, I mean, you know, if you're going for a cool teacher, he had gauges in his ears, wearing a suit, and evidently he's tatted all up and down his arms with literary sayings.
Oh,
that's so he's into it.
Very much so.
But it was, speaking of an AC/DC class, I'm just like thinking there's a Kardashian class, there's a Walking Dead class, there should be a Bill and Wendy class.
You could get a class for anything. I would be... I wish they had that when I was in school. Everything we had, like math and science and stuff, and I never use any of that. So this would come in a lot handier.
Maybe Drake LaRoche would go back to school if they did cool things like that.
Well, it's funny you bring up Drake LaRoche.
Who hasn't brought him up? Poor kid.
Kevin is searching for the newest version of this story for me, but it came out over the weekend, and I alluded to this the other day. This has been such a big story, not just locally, but nationally. Just very quickly, the bare basics, in case you don't know. Adam LaRoche was a member of the Chicago White Sox. He liked to bring his son, who's 14 years old, Drake, to the ballpark with him. And I said last week, I guarantee you some players are complaining about this. Even though no players were coming forward, there's got to be some players who are saying to the general manager, Kenny Williams, hey, do something about this. We're trying to play baseball. We want this to be a baseball team, not a kinder care, and you got this 14-year-old kid. But the way it played out last week, there was no evidence at all, and then over the weekend it became apparent, and I don't have the story, Kevin is searching for the new version of the story for me, that yes, indeed, there were players on the team who privately came to the bosses and said, look, we like Adam a lot, and we like his kid a lot, but this is ridiculous that there's a kid in the ballpark, in the clubhouse with us all the time. Please do something, and he did, and it's tearing the team apart.
I feel bad, and I remember you saying that because I said no one's going to come forward because Chris Sale like stuck up for Adam LaRoche and said, hey, we didn't have a problem with this kid.
Right.
I still want to know why Chris Sale opened his big mouth.
I think at the time, and I would imagine still now, although there's been an edict from the heads of the White Sox as if to say to the team, we don't want to comment on this anymore. We've said enough. Let's let this thing play out and lay low. And Major League Baseball, this was my favorite announcement of the week, because I love when people announce things that really don't mean anything. Major League Baseball said that they are monitoring the situation. I have no idea what that means. It means they're doing what everyone else is doing. If you're a baseball fan, you're paying attention to it, but they're monitoring it. What are they going to? What could they do?
Well, and as you mentioned, Jerry Reinsdorf closed the door on the Adam LaRoche saga on Friday. He says he has met with Adam LaRoche, the team, and is declaring the saga over. In a statement Friday, I want to get Jerry Reinsdorf's thing, but he says no one's going to talk about this, basically.
Here's a story that was in the Tribune yesterday. Listen to this. In the case of Adam LaRoche and the clubhouse versus Kenny Williams, and that's really what it's come down to, is if you're looking at this story, it looks like you've got all these guys on the White Sox, all the players on one side, and then management, Kenny Williams, on the other. But it's not that clean. It really isn't. It says, in this story, there may actually be some players who are siding with the Chicago White Sox executive vice president. Here's what it says. Several players and staff members privately complained to White Sox management recently about the constant presence of LaRoche's 14-year-old son, Drake, in the clubhouse. Drake LaRoche, multiple people say, was with the team for about 120 games during the 2015 season.
How many games are there in
162.
A season?
That means three-quarters of the games this kid was there for.
All right.
That's a lot, isn't it? The officials spoke to USA Today Sports on condition of anonymity, because the club has forbid officials from commenting. And simply, not everybody felt comfortable with Drake's constant presence, who he was called the White Sox 26th man. Apparently, no one ever told LaRoche. See, that's the thing, and I alluded to this last week. In a situation like this, let's say you're a player on the White Sox, and this kid is around all the time, and even though you like the kid, you go, look, I can't be myself. His dad can't really always focus on the game because he's always keeping an eye and making sure. Natural things,
yeah.
Right? So maybe those things add up, and it hurts the team in the long run. The White Sox did not have a sparkling season. I'm not blaming all of it.
They've done pretty well at spring training.
They have done really well in spring training. But so what do you do? What do you take this information to? Do you confront Adam LaRoche directly as a player and go, hey, your kid's great, but leave him at home sometimes? Or do you say to management, part of your job
do something.
isn't that part of their job?
And yes, on Friday when we left, that statement, Adam LaRoche finally came out saying that if anyone had a problem with this, he would address it. And I was listening to Adam Hogue and Mark Carman over the weekend, and Adam Hogue made the best point. LaRoche said it himself. If anyone had a problem with this, it would be addressed. And from what Adam Hogue said, Kenny Williams went up to Adam LaRoche and said, listen, some people are complaining. Why don't we just cut this back to 50%? Just back it down a little bit. Mm-hmm. And according to Adam Hogue, Adam LaRoche then brought his son the next 4 days. So that is like completely going against what your boss has said. Well, you know, lay low for a couple of days, and that's when Kenny Williams came back and said, "Okay, it's done."
When you brought this up on either Thursday or Friday that he would address it, that's such a vague statement.
Right.
What does that mean?
Thanks for telling me.
Right. So now that I know you don't like it, guess what? You're going to see a lot more of my kid. So I mean, no one's fully in the right and no one's fully in the wrong. You can't criticize a dad, a parent, for wanting to be around their kid. That would be crazy. But by the same token, this is a job. I know it's called playing baseball, but it's a job, and their job is to focus on the games at hand, not babysit. So it really, I mean, you're right in the middle. It's tough either way.
My question to you is, why was it Kenny Williams that confronted Adam LaRoche and not Robin Ventura?
I think because, and this is just a guess, Adam LaRoche, has a lot more time. If he had stayed with the team, there's a lot more time spent with Robin Ventura as opposed to Kenny Williams. I don't know how often he sees Kenny Williams, but he sees Robin Ventura on a daily basis. So maybe it's easier when all is said and done to go one step or two steps above Robin Ventura.
So Robin doesn't have to feel weird about it?
Yeah.
Yeah, but isn't he the liaison between management and the players?
Probably should be, yeah.
Because I'm wondering if it would have played out any differently had Robin been the one to talk to him. And how's Chris Sale doing now? I know that they won and he pitched a great game over the weekend, and he's clearly going against management. How does that fly?
I don't think that's the best idea. I really don't. What he has on his side is he's one of the best pitchers in baseball. So the last thing the White Sox want to do is irritate him or move him, get rid of him, trade him to another team. They don't want that to happen.
Yeah, but can you allow him to stay on the team when he's been an insubordinate?
That's tough.
He's flat out saying Kenny Williams lied,
right,
and wrong person walked out of here.
Right.
And I just don't think that plays well for him.
No, in a blueprint of what you should and shouldn't do, going that blatant against management and calling your boss a liar.
It's called diva.
It is.
I'm curious to find out what happens to Chris Sale.
I wonder if at some point, this is the perfect ideal world scenario. If you're Kenny Williams, maybe you pull him aside at some point and you go, look, I don't want bad blood between us. You mean a lot to the team. I want you to stay and I want to stay, but you know, believe me, I'm not doing this to hurt you. I'm doing it for the best interest of the team. Wouldn't you do that? I would want to do that.
Is Chris Sale going to now come out and say, I take that back? I guess some people were complaining.
Well, now I wonder if you're Chris Sale, if you're one of the supposed team leaders, do you work on finding out who it was that complained about the kid, or do you just let it go? I would want to let it go.
He shouldn't even really be involved. I know he wants to stick up for a teammate, but this is kind of a personal issue,
right,
between Adam LaRoche and management. And if Paul Konerko was to, they have not had a, since Captain Paulie left, it's like they have no one who's taken Paul's place.
Right.
Is anyone saying, oh, wow, we really need Adam on the team, don't go?
No one's saying
no.
That.
No.
No
one.
We're not
no
good with Adams.
That.
Adam Dunn didn't do very well.
Right.
Adam LaRoche is now a bit of a problem.
I mean, right. Don't you think it's a little funny? I mean, A, that he's not facing any criticism for bolting on his team, you know, because he can't have his son.
Because they've turned it into this, he's a family man, he's standing up for what's right for him, but it's okay when you got a lot of millions in the bank.
Well, and I think it's just fascinating that no one is saying his absence, or I haven't heard it, maybe there are, that his absence is going to
hurt the team. No one said that.
He didn't do well.
No one's saying that.
Right.
Right. But if you read the national versions of this story, like I'm reading both the local versions, the Tribune and the Sun-Times and sports bloggers, but then I'm also reading the national, like CBS Sports. reporters. I read a couple of their accounts of the story. So when you read that, if you're living anywhere else but Chicago, what it looks like is it's just a simple story of a dad who loves his son so much that he's saying no to $13 million so he can pal around with his son. So you read that and you go, well, that guy's the greatest dad of all time. His son means more to him than $13 million. But there's much more to the story than that.
And as Adam Hoge pointed out, I'm a sports groupie, by the way.
I know.
I like listening to the beat here on the weekends. He was saying, all told, he's made like $56 million already. And Mark Carman said he's done the math and it's more like 70-some million.
Yeah.
So $13 million all of a sudden doesn't sound like it's that much when you have made that in the past and you've got a nice little bank account. I'd like to stand up for my kids' rights and stuff if, you know, if I have money in the bank to let me be brave. Yeah.
Right. Blank you money. That's what it's called, right?
And CBS Sports, how could you even listen to them? What was their headline about the Blackhawks?
Oh, no, that wasn't CBS Sports.
Oh, I'm sorry.
There was another. I showed Wendy this story, Steve, today that talked about how the Minnesota Wild lost to the Blackhawks last night. It was a major sports source saying that for the first time this season, the Blackhawks beat the Minnesota Wild. That was online today. And that's not how it played out yesterday. They couldn't have been more wrong.
And this was not The Onion. I backed you up on that.
No, it's real. It's real. All right, a quick break, and then more show. Bill and Wendy, WGN. All right, this is my fear about this story, and then we'll talk about other things, is, you know, opening day is less than 2 weeks away for the White Sox, and this has been such a...
Timing, man.
That's the problem, is that this is the last thing in the world a baseball team should be having to worry about as they're shoring up, you know, their roster and who's doing what and stuff. This gets in the way, and plus, now you'll have some dissension on the team as they're trying to figure out who are the players that... who didn't want the kid there. I had higher hopes for the White Sox than this. And it could be, I could be wrong. Who was it who the other day said, maybe this is the kind of thing that'll bring a team together?
There was some audio of one of the Sox players who said, you know, this has brought us closer together. But how could it?
I'm not sure how it could. I can't figure out how it would bring them closer together.
And Chris Sale is the one who is the different one in the equation right now, because if other people were complaining, Chris Sale totally had Adam LaRoche's back. So now is Adam looking around going, okay, or excuse me, is Chris Sale looking around the clubhouse going, are you the one?
Right.
Did you complain? Who complained?
Right.
I got to know. Who complained?
Yeah.
It's like he's involved himself where he shouldn't have.
Every time they show Chris Sale, I shouldn't say every time. It was only a couple of times. But in those couple of times, whenever they showed him at his locker, he's got the little kid's jersey hanging up on the side of his locker like a shrine.
He's gone. They can't keep him on that team. I know we need him for pitching, but that is like complete insubordination.
I think somebody at some point just has a word with him and says, look, we respect your opinion and we know you're a team leader. We appreciate all that. We want you to be a team leader, but you might be slightly off base on this. There were players that didn't want him. It's not just an issue that management made up for the sake of making. Management doesn't want there to be a problem like this. They want there to be, you know, some kind of peace on the field and in the locker room. This is the last thing management wants.
And how did it get out? Do we know that? Because it shouldn't have gotten out into our vision.
Without revealing a source, because I can't reveal a source, I know somebody connected to the White Sox who said a day before this story broke, the only story at the time was that Adam LaRoche was retiring, and the reaction there at White Sox headquarters was, well, something weird must be going on because there was no sign of him retiring. He was having a fairly decent spring. He had an awful year last year, but he seemed to be rebounding. Usually a guy in that position who's going to retire does it because they're having an awful spring and goes, I just don't have it for baseball anymore. But everybody was very optimistic about him. And a day before this became a story, word got out in the White Sox camp that he was retiring. And everybody's like, wait a minute, something's wrong. What is it? And now we know what it is.
I just wish it wouldn't have gotten out because we shouldn't know about this.
I keep going back and forth and back and forth.
It doesn't belong on the baseball field. This is something I feel like we shouldn't know.
Except there's so many guys whose job it is to, as awful as this sounds, there's so many guys looking for an angle that nobody else has. So if somebody discovers the story.
Oh, if I discovered it, I'd tell everyone.
You wouldn't sit on the story, right?
You'd actually join Twitter and start tweeting it if you found this out.
I might consider doing that, sure.
Oh, an embarrassment.
Sure.
Come on, Southside.
So, you know, we're hoping the team figures it out. There's still 2 weeks before opening day. Our fingers are crossed. Everything will be okay in White Sox land.
Well, they got 2 weeks before opening day and 6 weeks before they're eliminated, so there's a window there.
Somebody says, I'm going to switch stations if you keep up the LaRoche talk. 5 days is enough. And I agree, but it's like there are new developments and everyone is still talking about this. Thank God we're not talking about the presidential race.
If you watched any sports like on cable over the weekend, this is still, it's the biggest story in sports for some reason. And now it's supplanted by the tennis story.
Which we're going to talk about next.
Yeah, we'll cover that in just a little bit.
It's, all sports all the time. My name is, I need a nickname.
I think everyone in sports name is Mike now. It's Mike and Mike and Mike and Mike and Ike.
All right, well, I'm Mike. Are you Mike?
I'll be Ike. It's us. It's Mike and Ike on WGN. Steve, thanks very much. It's us. It's Phil Leff and it's Wendy Snyder. And we are joined right now by Ryan Burrow to talk about the other big sports story. We already covered Adam LaRoche. And no, this isn't an all-sports station, but there are some major, major stories
going
on.
Yes, it is, Mike.
It is, Mike. We are Mike. We are the other Mike and Mike.
I get to be Golic. I look like him, right?
A little bit.
Yeah.
Just a little bit.
Golic.
One of the Mikes.
One of the Mikes.
Oh, I'm
Mike
sorry.
And Mike.
Yeah. He's the big football player, dude, just like me.
Yep. Very similar.
Yes.
Very, very similar. Ryan, the world of tennis has been shocked.
Yeah, well, I guess shocked.
Mildly shocked.
Mildly shocked.
Let's talk about the statements of a man named Raymond Moore. Now, Raymond Moore is not a household name. He's a former player, South African in origin.
Sure.
Nearly 70 years old. He runs a tournament out in California. And I guess what he says matters, but he just said something that is upsetting a lot of people.
Yeah, very upsetting. Here it is.
They ride on the coattails of the men. They don't make any decision. They're lucky. They're very, very lucky. If I was a lady player, I'd go down every night on my knees and thank God there's a Roger Federer and a Rafa Nadal for, because they've carried the sport. They really have. And now the mantle is being handed over to Djokovic and Murray and some others. And you know, it's good. We have no complaints.
So kind of tough to hear, but he's saying if he was a woman tennis player, he'd go down on his knees every night and thank God that...
That men are involved in tennis because they are carrying the sport.
Yeah, very, very lucky. Obviously, that is not playing very well. That choice of words not playing very well. Talking about how the women, the WTA, basically rides the coattails of the men's side. You're a tennis player.
Yeah.
I mean, we've seen a lot of success on the women's side of late, right? Serena Williams is a prime example of that. Venus Williams
as
well.
The Williams sisters are certainly at the top of the class, but there's other female tennis players. It's one of those sports, and I guess you could say this about almost any sport where both men and women play it. Just by nature of the way sports is, the ratings are higher when men play than women. It's still an incredibly exciting game to watch when women are playing. I find myself watching nearly as often when women are playing as men playing. But I don't know it's anywhere to the extreme that he just described it. I don't think so.
Do you think that perhaps being a tennis fan that maybe we're in kind of a lull of women's tennis? I mean,
no.
Is that you? Because you can interpret, obviously, what he said has offended a lot of people. But perhaps maybe there is something in it, whereas, you know, just kind of an identity of where the sport is right now. I mean, we've seen this with golf, right? Tiger Woods was the guy. And now we've kind of split off and there are a bunch of other guys as well. But obviously what he said is not sitting very well. Serena Williams calling it a disservice, the whole get on your knees, which is offensive enough, according to her. She said,
and while
that
you're down there,
women have come a long way. That's what Serena says. Billie Jean King saying it's wrong on so many levels. He went on, by the way, this CEO Raymond Moore saying there are a handful of very attractive prospects that can assume the mantle. And people say, well,
attractive,
wait a minute.
Does he mean attractive that or was, does he mean
that,
good players?
That was the next question. And he, you know, stepped back and said, whoa, 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 I mean both. So, I mean, he sees that there being an opportunity with attractive young females coming onto the circuits that perhaps a way to kind of rejuvenize the sport. But no way to read this sounds good. By
Ryan,
any means.
You play tennis?
No, not
okay,
really.
Bill, you do, and I was talking to you off the air. You do watch tennis on TV.
I do.
I never have. Maybe occasionally Monica Seles I watched, but some of these big name in women,
yeah,
that's what got me more interested in it, to say the least.
Sure, no, exactly. And like I said, on the golf side with Tiger Woods, you know, we were all watching, not because we loved golf, but we just wanted to see if Tiger Woods could do it. And I think there is a Serena effect as well, and a Venus effect, especially here in the United States. We may not, associate ourselves much with the European or the Russian athletes, and we need that American. But Serena and Billie Jean King stepping up and kind of going after this guy. And he came out and apologized. By the way, the International Tennis Federation President David Haggerty also called the quotes irresponsible and offensive. So
they are.
They aren't going unnoticed, that's for sure.
And who's the guy who said these quotes?
This is CEO Raymond Moore of the BNP Paribas Open, which took place in California over the weekend.
He should be ashamed of himself.
It's really, you know, like I said a little while ago, if you look at any sport where both men and women compete, I'll use the NBA because this is a great example.
Sure.
If you watch a basketball game on television,
we got next.
It's your professional basketball players. There's not an empty seat anywhere. Then you turn to a WNBA game, sure.
Are they still playing?
They're still playing, but they're just barely getting by. You know, it's just
that's almost, in my opinion, like it happened too late. You know what I mean? We had men's basketball for so long, and I felt like, had it happened sooner, I played basketball in high school, I would have been more into it.
Right.
It like took so long for it to happen, in my opinion. And, you know, there's the lingerie football teams.
There is that. Yes. Yes. Which some may say is wrong and glorifying.
You know what, though? I have to tell you, I was in, obviously, at Notre Dame, they've got a wonderful women's basketball program. DePaul. DePaul has a fantastic women's basketball program. South Carolina's got great team this year.
Right.
UConn is always
but
great.
That's college
Tennessee
level.
Is always great. But, exactly. But at those schools, that is the big moneymaker. Those can be the big moneymakers at that school. So I think it just kind of depends. People want to see good athletes, you know, regardless of whether they're on the men's or women's side, and you know, try to find try to go to a basketball game at South Carolina, a women's game versus a men's game. It might be easier to get a men's ticket than a women's ticket.
Do you know who's had the top women's tennis team in college for, I would say, almost the last decade?
No, who's that?
Northwestern.
You're fun at parties, aren't
nobody,
you?
Yes. I have a little trivia booth set up and. For 50 cents or a bag of M&Ms,
sure.
I will share a fun fact. But nobody knows that unless you're so into tennis like I am.
Sure.
No, that doesn't get any attention here in town.
Right.
You know, but if it was a guys team, if they had the guys number one anything team at Northwestern, we'd be jumping all over that.
Sure. I mean, DePaul's a great point. I mean, there were no NCAA teams locally or no teams that made the NCAA tournament locally on the men's side or, you know, even Northwest Indiana. I guess Notre Dame would be the closest thing we have to a team that made the NCAA tournament. But, you know, like I said, DePaul's in it, and you know, really the coverage.
Now, to make
really
the story
there,
even crazier, Novak Djokovic, who is the number one tennis player in the world right now, he then made a statement about how men really. He was sympathetic to the battle that's going on here between men and women, but he said, really, if you look at it, men should get much bigger cash prizes also.
Why?
For the points we were just making is that the ratings are so much higher. I hate to say it, but they are. They're not even close when it comes to men's sports versus women's sports. I'm not saying that means guys should get more monetarily, but sponsors pick up on this. They look at the ratings.
Typical men getting paid more than women.
I don't think Bill can run for president now in 2016.
I wasn't going to run in 2016.
Why? More people will love you the more crazy stuff you say.
I know that Kanye West is going to win that presidency.
It's true.
I'm going to go 2020.
It's bound to happen.
So men may have played these various sports first, but, you know, so in a way maybe they paved the way, but, you know, there's no need to get down on our hands and knees and thank them.
No. Not even close.
Not even close. I don't know if he meant that to come out the way that it did, but I don't know. He's certainly
can't
taking
really
the burn for it.
Take
today.
That another way.
No, you really can't. You right. really can't.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Ryan. And coming up next, 5 traditionally male jobs that you didn't know women pioneered. Can we discuss that?
Yes, absolutely. That's coming up next. Thanks, Ryan. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.
A little something in the news about the Tennis Association and some man who said that, you know, women should get on their knees and thank God that men are playing.
Raymond Moore is his name. Raymond Moore is the guy.
630 says, as a non-tennis player slash fan, I know absolutely nothing about men's tennis or any male players. I can, however, name about 10 female tennis players and know enough to know what's going on currently with those players.
Perfect.
They really, the Monica Seles, I love the way she grunted.
Yep.
Eh!
Isn't that fun?
It was kind of fun. Mm-hmm. Of course, the Billie Jean King, Bobby Riggs thing that came.
Battle
what
of the Sexes.
That?
Oh, boy. 70s. Early 70s. Yeah. Early 70s.
Wow.
And they made there was a movie about it a couple of years ago. I didn't get to see the movie, but that was quite a story. I think the world, or most of the world, was pulling for Billie Jean
yep.
King in that, and she did end up winning.
Because he was just such a pig.
Yeah. Wasn't that the name of his supporters, were the Riggs Pigs?
I think
those
so.
Those are the people who were on his side.
That's ringing a bell.
Yeah.
All right, well, Huffington Post Women put together a list of male jobs that you didn't know women pioneered, and I would like to share them with you. The first computer programmer ever was a woman.
Yeah.
Yep. Today's tech world is notoriously male-dominated, with women holding less than 25% of science, technology, engineering, and math jobs nationally. And
why would that be, by the way? That's surprising that it would be that different in numbers. Why wouldn't women have more of a say in the tech world?
Maybe they just don't want to be involved in it.
Is
they
that
have
it?
Other things they want to do. But the gentlemen of Silicon Valley owe a lot to the 19th century founder of scientific computing, Ada Byron, Countess of Lovelace, or Ada Lovelace. She collaborated with Charles Babbage, the so-called father of computers, and wrote the world's first computer coding algorithm.
And when was this, does it say?
What year?
That's all right.
During World War II, six women mathematicians, nicknamed the Human Computers, did most of the programming for one of the world's first all-electronic computers. Women remained prominent in computer programming through the 40s and 50s, but their numbers decreased as the industry adopted a number of recruiting techniques that favored men in the late 60s.
Yeah.
There's your answer.
Yeah. So this is when computers were the size of a room,
yeah,
right?
Or the Trib Tower.
Right. Right.
But the world's first computer coding algorithm done by a woman.
How about that?
Ada Byron. How about, for most of human history, women brewed those ever so manly barrels of beer?
I could see women being important brewers, sure. That doesn't surprise me. I've seen a St. Pauli girl's bottle. That girl looks like she knows what's working.
Oh,
she's one of my heroes, that girl.
Today, women make up less than 1% of workers that are employed in beer manufacturing. But evidence from ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics suggests that women were originally responsible for brewing beer, which was considered a feminine domestic task for centuries.
Was it really, yeah?
Throughout Europe in the Middle Ages, women were masters of brewing, and many of these so-called alewives or brewsters used their talents to earn pocket money.
Alewives? Really?
I thought those were fish.
They are. I wonder why would they equate those with those?
Well, ale, beer.
No, I don't know why women were referred to that if they were female brewers. I get that. But who looked at a fish washed up on a beach and said, that reminds me of the women from years and years ago who used to brew beer. Let's call those alewives in tribute.
We'll have to look that up.
I don't understand the tie-in.
With the industrialization of the 17th century, beer became a large-scale factory business, and those factory jobs were given to men.
Hmm.
But guys, when you go have that beer at happy hour or tonight when you get home, you can thank a woman for it.
The early days of beer were dominated by women.
From 1916 to 1923, American women had more power in the world of movie making than in any other domestic industry.
No, that's a surprise. I didn't know that.
For decades, women have been completely outnumbered in nearly every aspect of the film industry. Yet in the early days of silent film, movie making was one of the most female-friendly fields. Indeed, hundreds of women worked as writers, directors, producers, and editors in the early 20th century, and many of their stories were only recently uncovered by Harvard professor Jane Gaines.
Even you said directors, right?
Yeah. Gaines determined that from 1916 to 1923, women actually held more power in the film industry than in any other industry in the United States.
Boy, that's a surprise.
Unfortunately.
Even today, I think women directors are somewhere around 5%. It's really, really low. So I wonder, That's surprising that it would have been that high.
Well, she says, unfortunately, 90% of American films made before 1929 were not properly preserved, so much of their work cannot be enjoyed today.
Oh.
In 1923, more independent studios were owned by women than by men, a phenomena that Playboy dubbed the her own company epidemic. Then, as the industry became centralized, a few powerful male-owned companies took hold and women were pushed out of most of the available jobs. Meanwhile, several authors of important early film history books ignored women's films and achievements, and many of these influential women were nearly forgotten.
I've read so many books about the early days of film, and none of them mention that. Not a single one.
Well, let's talk to Jane Gaines.
Put her on.
Oh, that's
I would love to talk to Jane Gaines.
This is exciting. Women were the original drummers.
Yes. I knew that.
You did not.
Why would women just be drummers for no reason?
Today, percussion instruments are typically seen as masculine, associated with military marching bands or rambunctious rock stars. Yet ancient artifacts and paintings reveal that ancient women were the original drummers. The first known drummer in history was Lipishau.
Yep.
Lipishau, wow. She was a Mesopotamian priestess.
She was an incredible drummer.
Drums carried connotations of birth and fertility and were sacred to women. Women played drums during religious rituals for about 3,000 years of human history. That all changed when the Christian church banned women from singing or playing instruments.
Oh, come on, Christian church. Rethink that.
Damn you.
Rethink it.
Public performance of music increasingly became the turf of men. Pretty interesting. Take that, Bonzo. And finally, while the medical field, we're talking about things that women actually paved the way for men.
They pioneered these things.
Yes.
All right.
While the medical field excluded women doctors for hundreds of years, women were some of early mankind's most prominent healers.
Mm-hmm.
Many women were highly respected medical experts in ancient Egypt and ancient Greece. Throughout Europe's early history, nuns frequently worked as healers, and some like Hildegard of Bingen wrote influential records of their cures and treatments they use. That would be Hildegard of Bingen.
Yeah.
Yes.
Also, by the way, a pretty good drummer. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah.
Well, Hildegard wrote influential records of the cures and treatments they used, often in the fields of gynecology and childbirthing practices. That makes total sense.
You would think they would be in on that, sure.
Then, in the late Middle Ages, the church decreed that all doctors must obtain a university education. At that time, women were banned from attending universities.
There's the catch.
And thus could not practice medicine legally.
Yeah.
Damn.
That's not fair. It's not fair to Hildegard of Bingen, and it's not fair to any woman anywhere. I'm going on record as saying that.
Historians wrongly assume that Trotula, a renowned 11th century female professor of medicine and author of a classic book on medicine, was a man. But no, Trotula, a renowned 11th century female professor of medicine, was indeed a female.
She was, all right.
Mm-hmm.
Are you delivering this lecture off the top of your head?
Yes. They couldn't believe a woman had written such an influential medical book.
Why?
Because it was a woman.
Oh, that's upsetting.
And finally, even when women faced social and educational barriers to enter the medical field, they continued to heal those who could not afford doctors. In recent decades, women have made incredible progress in the medical field, although sexism still lingers.
You've seen the movie Borat, right?
Yes.
One of my favorite moments in Borat is when somebody's explaining to Borat that his wife is a doctor, and Borat laughs hysterically as though it's a joke, because he can't fathom the idea that a woman could be a doctor. It would never occur to him.
Well, we drummed, we played, we were doctors,
sure.
We brewed beer.
Yep.
God, we deserve all the credits.
The five most important jobs.
Computers? Seriously, you can go have a beer tonight, play with your iPhone,
yeah.
Waiting in your doctor's office while listening to Led Zeppelin,
yeah.
And watching a movie, and know that women pioneered all
Thank
that.
Thank women for all of that.
Yep.
Thank you, ladies, and Hildegard of Bingen, who I'm a huge fan of. Always have been. We're going to take a quick break. Steve has the news, and then a whole bunch more coming your way after that. Bill and Wendy, WGN. Steve, thanks. Earlier in the show, you and I discussed the fact that there was a huge convention in town over the weekend. The C2E2 convention was at McCormick Place. And it's an interesting thing. If you're involved in that world, in comic books or media, It's a fun convention. It runs Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
It is really fun. And we were talking, you had mentioned about a guy who was dressed up as something, and we weren't sure what it was. We have since found out. Would you tell us his description
again? This was a guy, I would say, maybe around 30, a tall, lanky guy who was only wearing his underwear or underpants. If you want
to
get a cheap laugh, I'll go for it. He was only wearing his underpants. And then he also, in addition to just walking around in just his underpants, this guy had little splotches of grease on his arms and his chest and his legs, and I had no idea who he was supposed to be.
None of us here knew, and we got a million texts saying that it was from the Family Guy. There's a character, they said the deaf guy.
I Googled a picture of him to see, and I believe that's exactly who this guy was supposed to be, because the cartoon version of it and the guy that I saw, the other cartoon version of him, matched up perfectly. So that I guess that's who he was supposed to be. But I would say of the costumed people walking around, the people that were wearing what they call cosplay costumes, I didn't recognize about a quarter of them. I have no idea who they were supposed to be.
And you had also mentioned something that, you know, on the back of your press pass or your lanyard, it said cosplay people. Cosplay doesn't mean groping or something.
Yeah, there was words to that effect. Just because someone's dressed up like Poison Ivy from Batman doesn't mean you can touch her.
It says cosplay doesn't equal consent.
That's what it meant. That's what they said, yeah.
Groping was not on
I wrote that on mine. As a I'd show people as I'd pass them. I'd go, look, just because this person is dressed up like one of the Powerpuff Girls doesn't mean you can smooch her. So do not.
Smooch. You're cute.
I by the way, at lunch, had a discussion about, and you were at the same lunch, and several people believe that the people who dress up in these outfits then go back to their hotel rooms and have very, very crazy bouts of amorous sessions.
Is that what you call it?
No, it's cross comma sex.
That's what it is.
Right.
That's exactly genre. What it is.
Cross sex.
It's cross sex. Don't you think that plays into it, though? Because
some people.
I don't know what's in it. Right. Not everybody.
One of my sons dressed up as a Ghostbuster. He was not going home and having amorous sessions, maybe with himself, but not with anyone else.
But he's not 28.
Right.
You know, if you get to be that age and you're dressed up like a Powerpuff Girl.
Right. Don't you agree, Steve? There's something.
Absolutely.
There's something pseudo-sexual in it for somebody to then, if you're dressed like a Powerpuff Girl and you go, oh, I'm dressed like this, and that guy's dressed like Aragorn from Lord of the Rings, I bet this will be fun. And then, you know, a lot of uppy-downy.
Well, whatever floats your boat.
Right. Yeah.
In the sea. Uppy-downy.
Right. So one of the aspects of this particular convention is collectibles. That's the reason I go. I collect goofy stuff, pop culture stuff. Well, they've just put out a list of things that if you have been investing in this, thinking, well, this is good because I have this to fall back on now. I can either pay for my kids' college fund or I can retire on this. You're in trouble because this stuff isn't worth anywhere near what you thought it was going to be.
Can I just tell you, though, knowing you and knowing my husband, the collectibles are not something you would sell for your kids to go to college.
Ever.
So that, right. I don't think people get into it.
From an investment standpoint?
Yes.
Well, talk to, you know, Steve Cochran. Did you ever meet Steve Cochran? He does the morning show here. One of these things is on his list, and that is Beanie Babies. I remember for years he was telling me he was stocking away these Beanie Babies because he goes, these are going to be worth an absolute fortune.
Oh.
And now if you ask him, he'll tell you he's got like a warehouse full of them and nobody's buying them.
Oh, my God. I'm so embarrassed for him. Was this for air?
Nope.
Did he want
he
you to
said
say-
to me particularly, he goes, do not mention this on air. So I'm not going
to. If I ever meet him, I'm going to bring this up.
I think you'd like him. It said, if you had a pulse in the early 1990s, then you probably came in contact with at least one of these ubiquitous animal-shaped beanbags. You know, everybody knows Beanie Babies, right?
Ty Warner, right?
Ty Warner. From here, I believe, from Chicago.
There was Ty Warner Park.
Yeah.
Oak Brookish, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. He was the brainchild behind them. Beanie Babies weren't so much a collector's item as they were a child's toy, but when manufacturer Ty Inc. started rolling out special editions, such as the Princess Diana Beanie Baby.
Grateful Dead had one, too. It was tie-dyed.
They did. I remember those.
Uh-huh.
They also made Millennium Bears. People started hoarding the things as though they were rare gems. Now you can't give them away, says an expert.
That's sad.
It's so sad, but it's so true. I'm trying to remember after Beanie Babies, because my daughters came after that was a craze. There were these things called Webkinz.
Oh.
Do you remember Webkinz?
Yeah, my kids were into it. The same kind of concept.
Except there was an online component. They would give you like an 8-digit code on a card, and then you would type that into your computer, and then you could act out like if it was a frog or a duck or something. You had an online version of it that you could win things for.
And can I tell you this? That is how my obsession with Candy Crush Saga started, because there was a game much like Tetris, which is kind of like Candy Crush anyway.
Right.
There was a game on the Webkinz and on the website, and I used to play that using my son's account.
Yeah. And then you, those points could be accumulated, and you could buy them like a treehouse or a boat.
Yeah. That was a cute little thing.
Those were great. But the same thing with those. There were some rare ones, and I didn't want to pay more than $6 or $7 for one.
If I hear the word rare one more time, because I have teenage boys, especially Dylan, who's 13, who will say, you know, oh, this is a very rare such and such. And I'm like, they just say that to you, so your parents will buy it. It's not that rare.
It's true.
I hate that word now.
Very true. Well, if you're investing in those, good luck to you, because they're not going to be worth what you thought.
Poor Steve Cochran. He really still has some.
Put all of his money into Beanie Babies. All of it. He lives under a viaduct by me. I see him on my way home. I feel so bad for him.
Wanted to be a Beanie Baby Baron. It turned out to be a Beanie Baby Boondoggle.
That's it. Exactly. It's so sad. How about this? All the people who invested in modern baseball cards, you're out of luck. It said the 80s and 90s saw a massive baseball card balloon that made many modern ball cards, those are the ones after the 1970s, pretty much worthless. Manufacturers were coy about how many cards they were printing. This according to Zach Bissonette of Heritage Auctions. Once you had eBay, a searchable database of everything everybody wants to sell, it became obvious that this stuff was not so rare. Don Mattingly rookie cards at one point were selling for $50 a pop, and now you can get them for under a dollar.
What about the Honus Wagner card?
That's still worth a fortune.
But the modern day ones, nothing.
Anything that was made probably after 1970, because that's when people picked up on the fact that if we just stock these away, they'll be worth something. But anything prior to that, and even then, you can find really cheap ones. What you have to do is find like one of the icons of baseball and find their rookie card, and then you're in good shape.
Dylan just got Mad Magazine cards at the C2E2, and those were pretty cute looking at. What, me worry?
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Dave. You have a very pleasant Beanie Baby story, don't you?
Yeah, my girlfriend at the time, now wife, she, in her paycheck, not in her paycheck, but with her paycheck, she'd get 3, 4, 5, 6 of these every week.
They paid her in Beanie Babies?
No, she used her paycheck.
A paycheck, and then a couple Beanie Babies to go with it. And when it came, she did this for like 2 years, maybe a year, and sold them on eBay for like a huge, like $1,800 for a box full of them.
Really?
Really.
When was this?
99-ish.
Yeah?
Right around there. And we literally put that money down on a house, and that was the money we put down on a house.
That's not bad.
That's awesome.
Why did the business... She didn't work for Ty Warner, though, right? She worked for another company. Why did they decide to give...
store.
For where? A jewelry store?
Right. And they have these, you know, like in the corner, people would get them buying rings, and they'd give their kid a Beanie Baby with it, too. Whatever.
Wow, then she did all right.
She did great.
That's fantastic.
Poor Steve Cochran. He should have sold when it was hot.
Too late.
Thank you, Dave.
Thanks, Dave. Yeah,
another Beanie Baby story. Brian's on the line. Hey, Brian.
Hey, guys. Yeah, back when they were big, the Dolls just had a promotion. We were giving away like little mini Beanie Babies with their Happy Meals and stuff.
Sure.
And the Dolls was always like jam-packed with people wanting to get those. But on top of that, the people who were already collecting and hoarding and stuff, cars were pulling the parking lot on their trunks up, and people were selling Beanie Babies out of their trunks.
And you know what's so sad is I remember going to McDonald's very frequently to get these Beanie Babies.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when I go through the boys' closets way in the back, I find them and I just give them away to Goodwill.
I know.
You know, the other thing, too, the last guy you just talked to, I've been working in the mortgage business for about 35 years.
Mm-hmm.
Back in those days, I did a couple of loans where people actually were documenting the sale of Beanie Babies with a down payment.
That amazes me.
Wow. That says a lot. Well, thank you so much, Brian.
No problem.
Appreciate it.
Seriously, Steve Cochran should have sell when it's high.
That's what you're supposed to do.
Don't get a warehouse full of them.
I don't know why he did that. All right, we've got more of these. These are things maybe you or somebody you know invested in these things thinking, oh, I'm on Easy Street. I've got a whole bunch of these. You're wrong. We'll tell you what they are next. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.
All right, we're talking about collectibles. We were talking about Beanie Babies. I did not know that Steve Cochran had a warehouse filled with them, but someone suggested at least now he can give his granddaughter, Abigail, a Beanie Baby every year for the next 12 to 14 years, and maybe they'll be worth something.
Steve has a lot of them. He could give his granddaughter one every 20 minutes and still have some left over.
Flora, you have a lot of Beanie Babies too, huh?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I have three grandchildren, and I was going to get every one of them every Beanie Baby. The fourth grandchild came later, so I had to go searching for those Beanie Babies. So I would say, conservatively speaking, I have 500.
500. Oh, man.
And all the grandkids don't even want them.
That is so tragic.
Well, because they're between 18 and 20, the older ones. The young ones still would like them, but, you know, they're not worth anything now. She can have them all, but her palm would kill me.
Yeah, but, you know, if you have 500 of them, you know, those little ball bounce things where kids go, and you can just set up all 500 let them, you know, lay in round in there.
I've actually decided I'm going to find, like, a UW. I live out in Wisconsin Dells. I think I'm going to take them to UW and give them to, like, the cancer ward for the kids.
Oh, that's very nice.
Well, that is nice.
You know, something that will be useful.
Sure.
Or you can just dump them off the stand rock during a Native American ceremony.
Sure, do that.
I like it, but the dog doesn't catch anymore, so how would we do that?
Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Flora.
Have a good one.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
All right, if you're just joining us, you may have invested in some things at some point in your life thinking, if I collect these at some point, they're going to be worth a lot of money. We've already told you baseball cards, not a good idea. Beanie Babies won't really do it. How about these Precious Moments figures? Remember those Precious Moments figures?
I didn't like them. Those were the first animes with the big eyes.
I guess they would qualify as that. Kathleen Guzman, who is an auctioneer over at Heritage Auctions, called the Precious Moments craze of the 1980s even more frightening than the Hummel figurine bubble.
My mom was into that. She had all the Hummel figurines. They were made in Germany, and it was like, you know, a woman in a skirt carrying a basket with a little dog, and then there was a kid sitting there reading a book and someone else flying a kite.
Yep.
They weren't cute.
Now, I always equate those with, I want to call them winter cottages, but I could be wrong. But people who collected those would also have these little, like, small versions of cottages. Did you ever see those?
I think they may.
Too small for the Precious Moments for Hummel figurines. But it just seems like something that everybody's aunt saved. You know, like, anytime I see those, I go, I bet my aunt would enjoy those.
I never liked the Precious Moments. At least the Hummel figurines looked like a human.
They were more if I remember the difference, Precious Moments were always like a muted.
They were more pastel, and they had the big eyes like the anime.
Right, right, right. You're right. Yeah.
They were.
It said while there were a limited quantity of Hummels and Precious Moments dolls, they were actually incredibly overproduced. Would they say, like, when you'd buy them, would they say number one out of, they would tell you how many were in the run, wouldn't they?
I think so.
Right? It said the company advertised that they were producing at one point 3,000 of each figure in one day. So think about it. You didn't stand, if you were buying this from an investment standpoint and they were making 3,000 of the little shepherd boy, you couldn't sell that. Anybody who wanted it had one or two or three of them. You didn't stand a chance.
No, and they still sell them on PreciousMoments.com. And do you know they have a whole Disney thing?
Of Precious Moments? No, yeah. I didn't know that.
All of a sudden.
Bing, 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 bing.
I hear it's from Lady and the Tramp.
Oh, yeah.
And then they have
bad looking.
Miss Piggy
looking.
Hanging out with somebody else.
Yeah. Now listen to this. These figures are now selling on average. These are Precious Moments that people thought, boy, if I just stock a couple of these away, I am set for life. It says on average they're selling for less than $5 each.
All eBay. Right, well, buy them on eBay because on PreciousMoments.com they're still $40.
The Disney ones are, right?
Yeah, but let's see now. What do you want? There's an annual Santa, an annual Nutcracker, because people do collect these things.
Of which? Of Precious Moments or Hummel?
Oh, Hummel,
look
I'm not looking
for
at.
For Hummel, I want Boy with Accordion. That's the one I've always wanted.
Oh, we have that one. I could steal it. They're like $14.99, but it depends what Precious Moments you're getting. There's a figurine that says you're awesome, a little girl holding a sign.
I'll get that
for you.
That's the one I would.
That's
like.
Still $30.99
on their website, but
right.
On eBay.
So go to eBay is what we're telling you.
Considerably less.
I can't believe they're still selling Precious Moments. What was the? Oh God, what was that painting that everybody in the 80s had? Nagels. Were they Nagels?
Oh, yeah. Like, if you'd go to a hairdresser or to a barber shop, they all had Nagels up,
or my
right?
friend Sue's apartment.
She had a bunch, too? Yeah.
Yeah. Where are they now?
Nagel was the one. It was, like, the racy-looking women, right? Is that a Nagel?
With red lipstick and kind of black and red and white.
Yeah.
Not a lot of color.
Right.
God.
It looked like a Cars album cover.
Exactly.
Right? That was Nagel.
Exactly.
Yeah, those are worth Candy a ton. Up. Another one really quick. Now, this one I don't remember at all. Andy Warhol cookie jars. That one went right by me. After pop culture icon Andy Warhol died in the late 1980s, friends and family discovered one of his greatest obsessions was antique cookie jars. The jars, for a while, turned into hot sellers. This at his estate sale, some fetching as high as $250,000. But that's not a fair one, because that means you had to have a cookie jar that was actually owned by Andy Warhol.
Right. He had 175 jars in all. So these were just knockoffs.
Oh, they were? All right. Yeah, that's what it says. What collectors didn't realize was that their value expired not long after their owner did. And then an expert says, I tell people over at the Antique Roadshow that those jars are worth today what they were always worth, and that's about $200. But at some point, they were getting $250,000 for these jars.
And I think if you look at the picture, you kind of remember. There's one that says cookie time, and it's like a clock face or a cookie face.
No, I do remember
seeing these.
Yeah. I just went online.
Yeah.
I had a Nagel.
You did?
Did you really? You totally fit the mold. Because you get your first apartment. I was late getting my first apartment, but my friend Sue moved out very quickly, and she had like nice furniture, and there was a Nagel hanging over her couch.
Yeah. Every place I ever got my hair cut, from the time I was in like eighth grade till my late college years, every haircut place had one of them somewhere, like when you walked in. I don't know why. Why would they think?
Because they were trendy and they fit perfectly in a salon. They were very modern.
Yeah. Women with sunglasses and bandanas on, right?
Which one did you have, Steve?
I'm just looking at
he's so funny. He's like looking at him. Uh-oh, I had one.
Patrick Nagel Mirage Edition, the book. I think I
had that's one of the better ones, yeah. Yep. Very nice.
Thank you.
Wow.
Discerning taste.
Mm-hmm.
Graphic art. That was the first. It looked like a photograph, but it wasn't.
Right.
That sunglassed girl, I think everybody had. You saw that in every salon all over the place.
Well, she looked like all the girls in Robert Palmer videos.
Yes.
Right? So that was the same kind of a vibe. A lot of people want to talk about this. We're at 312-981-7200.
And you have more on your list, too,
I do
don't
have
you?
More.
Okay.
So stay where you are. We've got more show for you. If you can stay on hold, we'd love it. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.
Collectibles. We should have played Collective Soul.
Oh, next time. Here's the story. Maybe you or somebody you love said, hey, there's this trend going on right now. I'm going to sock away a whole bunch of things. I'm gonna save baseball cards or Beanie Babies or Hummel figurines, and we'll just put them away, and then years from now, we'll be millionaires. Well, it turns out that's not the case. A woman named Kathleen Elkins just wrote this great story for Huffington Post explaining that all the things that you thought would be worth a whole lot of money aren't worth much money. Very, very sad.
And you mentioned the Precious Moments.
Yeah.
Hey, Tom, you're with the Precious Moment Company? Sorry, I told everybody to go to eBay.
Please come to PreciousMoments.com. We'd much prefer that. We haven't gone anywhere. Precious Moments has been around for 38 years. It started out as just a three-dimensional gift. It was really a greeting card. It's a way to express a greeting.
That's a perfect description.
And it became a collectible. People just, we didn't make it a collectible. It became one, and people just flocked to it by the thousands. While we don't have as many people collecting as we used to, we still have, you know, thousands of people who look for our product every year.
And with people who have them, very few have just one or two, right? If you're into it, you're big into it, aren't you?
Yeah, some people are really big into it. Some people are casually into it. You know, one of my favorites, I may run up against somebody who says, I'm not really a collector. I don't buy them for myself. Well, how do you get them? Well, my husband buys one for me every year. And mm-hmm. My cousins know that I like them, so they buy them. I don't buy them, so I'm not a collector, but yet she may have, 100 pieces.
What's, of all the collectors you've talked to, who has the most? Do you know anybody in the thousands?
I know a few of them in the thousands.
Wow.
Over the years we've run into them. We have an event coming up. We call it our family reunion. Our collectors kind of consider themselves to be a family, and we have an event coming up in June at the Precious Moments Chapel in Carthage, Missouri. So we'll run into several hundred of our best friends, and some of them are the ones who have the thousand-plus figurines.
Wow. How about that?
Have they typically been like kind of, did they start as kind of a religious thing? Because there's really cute little figurines, which I noticed for somebody making their first communion. There's a wedding one that's really cute. I forgot how cute
they were.
There's
a nativity scene, too, I believe I've seen.
Yeah. It's light inspiration.
Sure.
The original artist, Sam Butcher, is very much an active Christian and used his Christian faith as his expression of his art. And while it touches religious, themes like First Communion and such, it also just covers general gift and fun things, friendship expressions. You mentioned the Disney earlier.
Yeah.
Our association with Disney is about 10 years old now, and it's been a wonderful association because we not only attract the Precious Moments enthusiasts, we now attract the Disney enthusiasts.
Well, congrats. Thanks for calling, Tom, and people can go to preciousmoments.com.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much. Good luck with your family gathering.
Did you ever see, there's a company, and I bought these as Christmas presents for friends and family years ago. There's this company that makes statues of Jesus playing sports with kids.
Oh, those are really funny.
I love those. I don't know what it is, but just the sight of Jesus, shooting a three-pointer with a kid trying to block him. And they're not meant to be funny in any way.
No, but they are comical
but
to me.
You see Jesus in a judo outfit about to, chop some kid. You just go, what happened that day? What happened there?
Those are, they're not meant to be funny, but you can smile about them because they're, God can play any sport is basically what it says.
The one I got for my parents is Jesus playing hockey, and then he's checking a kid into the boards.
Jesus wouldn't do that.
I don't think he would do that.
What would Jesus do? WWJD.
He wouldn't check a kid into the boards.
Paul, you have another collectible that people had. I wonder if it's on this list. What is it?
The Yadro statues made in Spain.
The artist was Yadro, 2LLADRO. Very popular.
What are those?
Blue and white and very shiny. And it was an artist who put together these figures. A lot of times people would get a Yadro figurine for a wedding gift. Is that right, Paul?
Yeah, well, I have a little story about the Yadro statues. Years ago, I was in Naples, Florida, and we're walking down the street, and we notice a Mercedes with a Spain license plate from Spain. Well, it turns out Mr. Jose Yadro himself was in his gift shop.
Oh.
And he was autographing these Yadros, and these ladies were snapping them up like popcorn.
I can imagine. To get an autographed one would be very cool.
Wendy just showed me a picture. I remember them now, Paul. The name didn't mean anything to me, but when I see them, I remember them, sure.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for reminding us.
Thanks, Paul. So those would have been popular about, when did they peak, would you say?
I want to say 70s.
70s,
maybe 80s. They're still available at Macy's. You can still get them. It's just you don't think to get them anymore, I think. What else is on the list?
They mentioned Cabbage Patch Kids.
Oh, remember that.
There was at least one, and I want to say two or even three Christmases, where parents were in such a frenzy for these things that as soon as a shipment would come into Toys R Us or KB Toys, they'd knock each other over just to get to the Cabbage Patch Kids, again thinking, this is a sound investment. I can't go wrong with this.
My niece is in her 20s, upper 20s, and she had to have one, and that was my first niece, and I remember just going all over trying to find one, and they had one with blonde hair, but she doesn't have blonde hair.
Right.
They had a redhead, she doesn't have red hair. So, I mean, I remember it was such a huge thing.
Oh, yeah.
And then my nephew had to have Cherry from Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Sure.
And he was, you know, kids are just so silly. He almost cried when he opened the package. He was like, it's Cherry! And then he played with the box and not Cherry.
Yeah, I know. That's going to happen.
Kids are so silly.
No children's playpen, it says here, was complete without these one-of-a-kind dolls popularized in the 1980s. Now, they say one-of-a-kind, but I believe they would mass market them and just put a different name on each one. So I guess you were getting something individual, but it looked like
the
other ones.
No, they all had their own like birth certificate, kind of like pound puppies.
But didn't they look kind of the same?
Oh, they all looked the same, like somebody smushed their face.
Right. It just had a different, they just stamped a different name on the birth certificate,
yeah.
Right? All right, I guess that's different enough then. Cabbage Patch Kid dolls were so in demand, it says here, that parents turned to the black market when retail shelves ran empty leading up to the holiday season. I still remember ads in both the Tribune and the Sun-Times, because this was in the days before the internet, where people in the want ad section could just name their price for Cabbage Patch Kids. They were so in demand, you could say, I want $200 for a Cabbage Patch Kid. And it was sold just like that.
That's when Craigslist was seriously a list.
Right.
You had to look it up.
That's right. That's right. The craze, the Cabbage Patch Kids craze, died down in the late 1980s.
Thank God.
Along with the doll's value, unless you have a rare edition, and that would be the African-American Cabbage Patch Kid with freckles, you probably won't fetch much for them on eBay.
They were different, because now you say freckles. I remember that there were some with freckles. Some had two freckles on one side. I mean, so they did vary them
right,
just a little bit.
Yeah.
But it looked like, you know, somebody like left a doll in the car on a hot summer day, and then somebody mushed its head.
Right. That was the look. If you had a, I hate to say this, but if you had a kid that looked like a Cabbage Patch Kid, you know, you'd have to take the kid in for an adjustment of some sort, wouldn't you?
Yes.
That wouldn't be a good-looking kid, the Cabbage Patch Kid. The eyes were too close together.
Yeah. Really
not I don't
a
know.
Good look.
No. For a doll, yeah, but for a kid, you know, if it was a kid, that would be a problem. Animation art is another one. I know so many people that invested in what they thought was a rare sell, you know, from a TV show. This is a Yogi Bear. It's a rare sell.
But it was just somebody
printed
it off.
Yeah. It seems like light years ago, the cartoons and animated films couldn't be made without two things, pen and paper. Back then, thousands of drawings, which are called cericels, went into a one-hour film. Afterwards, animation studios would sell these one-off drawings as art to eager fans. There was a time, listen to this. Oh, it actually mentions this in the article, but I knew this anyway. Over at Disneyland, this is in the 1960s, if you went into the gift shop, they would just give you these because they had stacks and stacks of these original cells. They didn't have room to keep them all. So they'd just give them to you. Do you want one? Here, it's yours.
Seriously?
Yeah.
And then they realize, wow, everybody's taking them. We can sell these?
Yeah, they must be worth something.
Wow. The
animation art cells were selling back in 1995 at Sotheby's Auction House for astronomical prices, some up to $10,000. How about that? But today it says you can't give them away. Now, that part's not true. If they're legit, if they're the real cells, they call them production cells that they used, those are still worth a lot of money.
How can
you
tell?
But the repro cells, that's the problem. It's almost impossible to tell what's real and what isn't. You got to get a really reputable dealer.
Well, we have an appraiser who wants to talk to us. So if we have any questions about what things are worth.
Oh, good.
Can we take a break?
Yep. Quick break. More show coming. Bill and Wendy, WGN.
Collective Soul, and
that's working. That
we're talking
good.
About collectibles. Did you collect the bulls?
So I have them all. So many people just figured out, boy, here's something. If I just hold on to a bunch of these for 25 or 30 years, I will be as rich can be. And now it turns out, according to an article on Huffington Post that Kathleen Elkins has written, all those things you've been stocking away in your storage room thinking you're going to be a millionaire, bad news, probably not.
Someone texted in, how much are my Playboys worth? Did people really think they were going to get money for Playboy magazines?
Yeah, not just Playboy. There was a place near me called Magazine Memories. It went out of business a couple years ago. And they had all the Times and Newsweeks and Mad Magazines and Playboys, you name it, like from every month that they've been in. And their game was, you would go in, like if it was your birthday, I would get you a Time Magazine or a Newsweek from the month you were born.
That's pretty cool.
It is cool, but sadly, not enough people were into that kind of thing.
I'd like you to get me a Playboy from February of 63.
I don't even think people were naked back in February 1963.
Hey, Louie, you're a certified appraiser?
Yes, I am.
What is worth anything these days? Because Bill's gone through the list of what isn't worth anything.
Well, you know, you really have to know the details of the particulars of the things you're looking for, and that's what, you know, professionals do. But it's very hard to go through all the crap that everyone's doing and figure out what is valuable.
Do you watch Pawn Stars?
I used to until I realized that most of those shows are salted with fake items.
That's true.
Not watch them.
That is true.
Is that the one with Chumlee and Rick? That's the one I watch. But they just they had a football that was allegedly autographed by all of the Chicago Bears.
Yeah.
And Dick Butkus's was not really his, but it was very common for the football to be taken into the clubhouse and like the trainer or somebody would try and sign it as close to possible. But so they have appraisers, various appraisers that show up on the show, and I kind of trust those people. Louie, what about you?
Well, that's what we do, and I am a certified appraiser, and my specialties are fine art, our graphics, our animation cells. I used to know Patrick Nagel personally.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
How about that?
He was a very nice man. And, you know, you get an original Patrick Nagel, there's still a value to it.
Really?
Get a poster, sure. But if you get a poster, and they made tens of thousands of posters, it has no value. But you need to know what the difference is, and that's what people don't know what they have in their home or closet.
Maybe you can find out what that artist is. Give the description, because Bill's been trying to think of this artist.
Around the same time, Louis, as Nagel, there was an artist, and we had two of his prints. He dealt with, like, California scenery, and it was all done in pastels, and it was really popular for a while. And then my wife explained to me nobody was hanging these anymore. We had to take them down. But do you know who that would have been?
I'm married, too, so I can relate. But,
is that ringing a bell?
No, you know, it's a visual thing. If you ever want to text me or send me a photo, I could tell you usually in about 2 minutes.
Oh, all right, all right.
You know, I mean, that's my specialty. But, you know, I'll give you a good for instance for what it's worth. You know, you all know Lalique.
Yeah.
All right, so everyone as a wedding gift 30 years ago got a little Lalique tchotchke of a bird bowl or something, right?
Right? Yeah.
Cost $100 then. You go to a store now, it's $800, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why is it worth more money if they've been making it for 30 years?
Just because so much time has passed? Is that why?
No.
No?
It shouldn't be. It would be worth more money if they stopped making it.
Oh, that's true. So why is it then?
It's so weird. I can't figure it out.
That is baffling.
Yeah.
I remember the Lalique. I remember the name, but it's just kind of colored glass, basically.
Yeah. The beautiful French glass with birds and nude women. And, you know, it's a very, very popular higher-end collectible. But they keep making the same piece, and it's literally made in a mold in France.
That's strange.
It's not like handmade.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a strange world. One of my best friends is the president of the Baseball Card Collector Society.
Uh-huh.
And I'll tell you, his favorite speech at the opening conference is, "Thank you, Grandma and Grandpa, Mom and Dad, for throwing away all those cards, making mine more valuable."
Yeah, that's true.
What about matchbox cars? Somebody wants to know if they're worth anything.
Well, but here's what it is. Anything that's mass-produced, really, unless you're getting something exceptionally rare, whether it's a rare one-off of a matchbox car or a Star Wars toy, doesn't carry a lot of value because it's mass-produced. What you're really looking for, if you're really looking to collect something of value, are the very, very rare vintage pieces, the one-of-a-kind things. Anything that's, you know, my joke is always, you can go right now and get a genuine antique reproduction.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Louie, we've got to run, but can we get your information? Because
we may need you from time to time.
Yeah, I can do this anytime you need help. I'm happy to.
Thank you, Louie. Appreciate it. All right, stay in line. Kevin will talk to you.
Maybe someday we can have him on and listeners can call with some of their collectibles.
That'd be great. Let's
set
that
up.
All right. We'll find out what Ro and Anna have coming up next. Stay here. It's Bill and Wendy WGN.